Let me know if you're ready. Good morning and welcome to the second day of our 64 the Abel Cannon Independent Safety Committee annual meeting. I am Peter Lamb. I am the chairman for the committee for this year. And let me introduce our esteemed colleagues on the committee. To my right is Dr. Per Peterson. Dr. Peterson is the chairman of the Nuclear Engineering Department at Berkeley. He also holds the Distinguished Endowed William Floyd Chair of Professorship at Berkeley, and he's also a member of the Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future. Dr. Peterson brings a great deal of expertise and experience to the committee. We are honored to have the association with Dr. Peterson.
Who have had the honor of that position.
Dr. Butners, thank you for your kind words. And also at our table here, to my far right, is Mr. Furman Wardell. He is our senior consultant. He's been with the committee for over 20 years. Now, the committee's been in existence for 22, so Mr. Wardell has been with the committee almost from day one. He brings over 35 years of expertise in nuclear reactor operations and management, Mr. Wardell. And to my far left is Mr. David Linen. He's again another senior consultant on the committee's staff. Mr. David Linen had served 5 years on a nuclear submarine, 10 years in a nuclear utility, and some 20 years at INPO, as a team manager, Mr. Linden. And then the second member to my far right, right next to Dr. Peterson, is our legal counsel, Mr. Bob Rahi. And Mr. Rahi has served the committee with distinction, and we don't know what we can do without his legal counsel. That said, let me go to the next item on the agenda. Any comments from our esteemed committee members? Dr. Peterson? Dr. Butners?
No, I'm great.
Okay. And now, this is a slot for public comments and communication. Any member of the public wish to address the committee on items not on our agenda, please come forward at this time. Ms. Lewis, would you please identify yourself for the audience?
My name is Sherry Lewis. I am a private citizen here, but I also am a member of the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. I was here yesterday, and I want to say how I do appreciate how this panel is very interested in keeping nuclear power safe. If we have nuclear power, then it needs to be kept safer, 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 and safer. And you all are doing a good job in making sure that that happens. But I want to register here, as other people do in other places, that nuclear power is inherently unsafe. It is an unforgiving technology, particularly when coupled with human error. People will always be making mistakes. They can be minimized, they can be covered, but things happen. And as time goes on and nuclear power waste goes on for a very long time, human error is bound to come in and cause some problems. And the technology, or just nuclear power, is too unforgiving. What I particularly object to, I know that your mandate is only to deal with the nuclear waste and make sure the canister, I'm confining myself to nuclear waste in this, that the canisters have to be safe for and licensed for 40 more years. Well, the waste within there will still be poisonous and so dangerous for thousands and thousands, if not millions of years. And I know you must confine yourself to the 40 years, but who takes care of after that? I mean, you can't just trust that somebody will take care of it after that. And I think because of that, that nuclear power needs to be phased out as quickly as possible. It is inherently too unsafe. Okay, thank you.
Ms. Lewis, thank you for your remarks. Any comments from committee members?
Certainly. I'd just like to say that I appreciate very much, Ms. Lewis, those comments, and also how you distinguished the differences between making nuclear power as safe as you can and the question of whether that is safe enough. And our obligation as a committee is to assure that the plant is run as safely as it possibly can be by assuring that it is meeting the highest standards that one can achieve, and to identify any place where things could be done better and make recommendations that it be done so. Our scope as a commission, or as a committee, also does not cover the question of what should be done with the spent fuel from Yucca Mountain in the longer term. In another role, I sit on this Blue Ribbon Commission that Peter Lamb mentioned, and from that perspective, what we can say, and if you read the draft report that the Blue Ribbon Commission issued on July 29th of this year.
Do you have any comments? Any member of the public who wish to address the committee?
Yes, I have something to say. I have something just to say. There are people watching. All of us have lives outside this committee, in which capacities we take all sorts of technical and policy positions. And as best I can do for myself, I try to divorce those positions from what we're trying to do here. I just want to make this it's a simple point to make.
Thank you, Dr. Bernes. If I may add to my distinguished colleague's comments, the committee's charter is well described in the trilateral agreement in 1988 between the California Public Utility Commission and the State of California Attorney General's Office and PG&E. More specifically, it says the committee is to conduct safety review of the Able Canyon's operation in full compliance of existing federal regulations. So our scope is broad and deep, but it's also limited by what the federal government, specifically the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission's rules and regulations are. Any more comments from the public on items not on our agenda? Please come forward at this time. And public comments are welcome also at the end of each agenda item. Okay, then the next item on our agenda is a representation. It's a presentation by PG&E. May I ask the representative from PG&E to identify and introduce himself, please? Mike.
My name is Bill Guldeman. I'm from Diablo Canyon, PG&E. I'm a director at Diablo Canyon, and I'm the person that's responsible for implementing actions in response to the events at Fukushima. What I will be talking about today is an update on information from Fukushima, both the plant and what's happening in the industry, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and at Diablo Canyon. I do appreciate the opportunity to address the committee this morning. Okay. With that, I would like to start with a bit of a review of information that was presented at the last meeting to make sure that we've got a common understanding of what's happening at Fukushima. As you recollect, there was a magnitude 9 earthquake, which caused an automatic shutdown of all the operating reactors and a loss of off-site power to all the reactors. The safety systems, including the emergency diesel generators, responded as expected following the earthquake. However, about an hour later, there was a large tsunami that struck the plant. Water was entered the plant, disabling nearly all the plant electrical and safety systems. There was one emergency diesel generator that was left on Unit 6. That was an air-cooled diesel generator that did provide limited electrical power to Unit 6 and Unit 5. The plant monitoring instrumentation largely was lost as a result of the inundation from the tsunami. That significantly complicated the ability of the operators to monitor plant conditions and to control plant status. Subsequently, the remaining core cooling systems failed, in particular the isolation condenser on Unit 1 and the reactor core isolation cooling systems on the other units. That prevented injection into the reactors at substantially high reactor system pressure. Water levels dropped below the top of the active fuel and rapidly proceeded to a fuel melt event in Units 1 through 3. Ultimately, the operators were successful in reducing the pressure in the reactors and the containments, and they did manage to use temporary equipment to begin injecting seawater to provide cooling to the reactors. The reactors are currently being cooled using fresh water, and at least the last report that I received, they were all at or below approximately 200 degrees Fahrenheit, and so in a much better condition than they had been prior to this point in time.
Yeah, the crucial thing is they got below 212 Fahrenheit, which is boiling.
And that allowed them to maintain atmospheric pressure.
That was the crucial sort of threshold on the safe side.
Correct.
Yeah, and to explain, one of the reasons for that is that means that by not producing steam anymore, you don't have a mechanism to transport radioactive material that could be carried with steam outside. And so it leads to better confinement of the radioactive material and less mobilization.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So may I also provide some context to this current discussion? Both Dr. Butness and Dr. Peterson are sitting on an advisory panel to Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu on Fukushima events. So this committee benefits from two of our members having timely and material information constantly from the federal government.
Okay. Thank you.
Could I ask a question? Blackout situation.
That would give us a definite advantage in response to loss of access to the ultimate heat sink. If the intake was significantly damaged such that we could not bring water from the ocean up to the plant, the diesel would still be able to run and supply electrical energy to the loads in the plant.
Okay. Yes. The air-cooled diesel generators are substantively better technology than the water-cooled because they have reliable heat sink. I think that in Japan there's of course going to be major modifications to plants, and one of the other things that one can do is to put in watertight doors to prevent the flooding of this type of equipment as well. But the Japanese are not going to restart plants until they've taken a number of measures to both increase the tsunami defense and also capacity to mitigate tsunamis if they should inundate the plant.
Just as a data point along those lines, the ultimate heat sink pumps, the auxiliary saltwater pumps at Diablo Canyon, which are located in the intake, are in watertight enclosures. The ventilation systems have what we call snorkels on them that extend well up in elevation and are higher than the design base of tsunami for the plant. So we believe that there's a very low probability that the intake would suffer as it did in Japan in terms of loss of access to the ultimate heat sink.
But on the other hand, I think out of the four stations that were subject to tsunami along the Japanese coast, all of them lost aux salt water, presumably in part due to just debris problems from the tsunamis. So the other important thing is the capacity to hook up and restore aux salt water using portable pumping equipment, which is now also installed at Diablo Canyon.
That's correct.
And again, you don't need aux salt water for your diesel generators to be able to function.
That's correct. And nor for our steam-driven auxiliary feed water pumps.
Yep.
Explosions occurred on units 1 through 4. Hydrogen explosions did occur. It's believed that the hydrogen was generated by the Zirk water reaction that occurred with the fuel as it overheated in the reactors, and it escaped the primary containments into the reactor buildings by various pathways, although that is not fully understood and characterized yet. And spent fuel pools did heat up owing to the loss of cooling when electricity was lost to the station. What do we believe to be known at this point in time regard to Fukushima? And hopefully shortly we'll have more information in this regard. It does not appear that the plant suffered significant damage as a result of the seismic event. That's based upon the functioning of the safety systems following the seismic event and inspections that have been performed at other stations that were subject to similar seismic accelerations. Containment venting did not occur in a timely fashion on at least one of the units until well after design pressure was exceeded. This may have contributed to one or more of the explosions where leakage from the containment at the elevated pressures allowed hydrogen to escape into the reactor buildings, but again, that's still being evaluated. Fuel damage due to overheating in the spent fuel pools at this point in time is now not believed to have occurred. There are some isotopic analyses that have been done in the pools that suggest there are fission products, but my most current understanding of that is that's believed to be due to debris falling into the spent fuel pools in response to the explosions and or earthquake causing mechanical damage to the fuel. So what are some of the significant lessons to be taken away from Fukushima at this point in time? If we go to the next slide. First, stations are susceptible to multiple unit events from beyond design basis phenomena. The design criteria in the United States historically has been to consider single unit events with the other unit available to supply support to the event that's under, or the unit that's undergoing the emergency. The events of Fukushima reinforced the importance of a robust capability to prevent or recover from a station blackout condition. The loss of AC power and DC power led directly to the core melt events that occurred at Fukushima. The importance of preserving DC power to facilitate plant monitoring and control has been reinforced by the events at Fukushima. And finally, the importance of managing spent fuel pool conditions under upset conditions and being cognizant of what is happening there as a potential source of radioactive release has been reemphasized.
Another reason why the spent fuel management under upset conditions, having preparations in place is important, is that it can divert important resources from working to keep the reactor safe as well. And arguably there was some of that happening also in Japan.
I think there was clearly competition for attention and resources in Japan, and thinking through those things in advance and making sure you have the right information and response capability is important. We'll talk a little bit about some of the things that are happening and have happened in that regard. A couple of things I want to reiterate about Diablo Canyon. We've already talked about this a little bit. Diablo Canyon does have 6 air-cooled diesel generators, 3 per unit. There is not a requirement in that regard. The current regulations the current regulation for station blackout is 50.63, and basically it specifies that stations be able to cope with a station blackout. Stations were required at the time of the promulgation of the regulation to perform coping studies to demonstrate how long they could cope. The coping studies were based upon the likelihood of having a station blackout, which included reliability considerations for the emergency diesel generators and estimates of how long it would take to restore off-site power. Most of the stations currently are licensed to cope for either 4 or 8 hours. Other stations, and it's a significant percentage of them, like Diablo Canyon, chose to either install additional diesels or do an analysis that said they had sufficient diesel generators, that the likelihood of having a station blackout was acceptably low.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Goodman, on the underground diesel storage tanks, do they have vents that are vulnerable to flooding and water intrusion?
They have vents. The vents are above the 85-foot elevation, which is the same elevation of the diesel generator. And so there's not a significant external flooding hazard at Diablo Canyon because of the site layout and the topography. The tsunami, design basis tsunami, is less than 85 feet, so we should not experience a flooding event. The vents on the tanks are above what is anticipated to be a level where they're susceptible to flooding.
So the issue is for Fukushima, even if they have underground diesel storage tanks, that would not have protected them.
If the vents were low enough and the water level was high enough, the tanks could have been inundated with water and the fuel could have been contaminated to the point where it would not support diesel operation.
Okay. So underground storage tank often by themselves may not offer protection. It's all a matter of elevation.
It's a matter of elevation and where the vents are and whether or not water can ingress into the tanks. And our design is such that we do not believe that would occur.
Yes. Sure.
If the plant adds closed-loop cooling with cooling towers up on the bluff, does that create a potential flooding hazard?
It certainly could. I mean, water could run down from the area above, but I'm not going to speculate on what that would look like and how that would affect our flooding analysis. Obviously, if you were to put closed-loop cooling up on the bluff in some location, you would have to consider the potential for flooding being introduced by the change to the plant.
Yep.
I guess the last thing we talked about is the fact that the plant is protected from a tsunami by the 85-foot bluff that it sits on. Again, this is information that I covered in my last presentation, but I want to touch upon it very briefly. We have engaged in activities to satisfy ourselves or confirm that we do have the capability to respond to significant events. We did walk-downs and verification that mitigating equipment for the beyond design basis events is available and functional. We did discover one long-term cooling water pump when we tested it that was non-functional. That was restored. Those pumps are regularly tested, and it had passed its previous quarterly test, and so this was deterioration that occurred in the interim. We have procedures in place to implement the strategies for events, and they are executable. We'll talk a little bit about some initiatives from the industry and the NRC in that regard going forward to improve the viability of those strategies. Staff qualifications were appropriate to implement the procedures, but as I'll mention later, we have done some additional training for our staff, both operations and emergency response organization. We did identify through these verification efforts some non-impacted shortcomings. Those items were entered into our corrective action program, and we are working through resolution. Those shortcomings would not have impacted our ability to successfully implement the strategies that we have in place.
How realistic are the training exercises for hooking up the portable water injection equipment?
They were actually walk-through simulations with operators in the field to look at the connection points to make sure people were aware of what the connection points looked like, where the equipment was, and that the strategies were right.
Since one of the things that was a serious problem here were the delays and the lack of timely response in initiating the water injection, which aggravated substantively the severity of the accident, I would think that setting up some mock-up equipment where people can physically practice getting pumps hooked up and running and injecting water would be a worthwhile thing to consider so that you can practice under more realistic conditions and have assurance that you can get the equipment installed and running in a reasonable time frame. And again, also recognizing that if you're doing this, it's because something fairly severe has happened to the plant, and if the installed equipment is not available. So I think that this is an area where more realistic training probably is worthwhile, rather than just having the theoretical potential of knowing what you think you would need to do.
Understand. Part of this as well is
that the time required to take these actions can be increased significantly if quick connect hardware is installed as well. So this is all stuff I really do think merits significant attention.
One of the objectives established as part of one of the industry initiatives in identifying needed portable equipment and strategies to hook up that portable equipment is to try to standardize the connections to enable us to use equipment from other locations, but also to make the connections what I'll call operator-friendly, that you have things that are like quick disconnects, whether they be mechanical, hydraulic, or electrical, so that you've got well-defined points. You don't have to go through a lot of maintenance-type activities to hook equipment up. It's plug and go. And so as we move forward, we'll obviously consider those things when we identify additional portable equipment needs to enhance our ability to implement those strategies in a timely fashion.
Yeah, I was just about to put you on the spot, but then I peeked ahead. And I'll let you get to the NRC stuff, and then I'll do it, because I think you may have answered the question I was about to ask. So go right ahead.
All right, thanks.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Or a comment. Pierre, as you recall, yesterday on the EDMG training, they do mock-ups of the portable equipment. They take the operators, they train them in the classroom on the procedures. They take them out into the plant and go visit all the equipment. I don't know if they actually hook it up or not, but they come close to hooking it up. They hook some of it up. So there are mock-ups done. I don't know the extent of it, but we could look into that some more if you wanted to.
And those were the walk-downs that I was referring to, that we typically do not hook that equipment up because, you know, now you're hooking in the permanent plant.
Of course,
equipment.
Not to the
risks by doing that.
Yeah, you would not want to do it to the actual plant equipment because
right.
that creates its own set of risks. But the other thing that was identified in the NRC task force report, which was important, is that inadequate attention had been paid to how hazardous or difficult the conditions might be for the operators trying to work in these areas to get the equipment hooked up. And besides evaluating what the conditions might be in terms of radiation levels or things of that nature, if you're doing this in the course of a severe accident, just the practice of having done it multiple times and therefore the ability to speed up the process also helps to deal with the potential that one could have hazardous conditions that you're trying to work under.
Understand.
And my question is, that was my comment, my question. A question came up yesterday about stranded plant.
Yes.
Due to a natural phenomenon. And I noticed you mentioned that in your presentation back in June. Could you elaborate a little bit on your stranded plant procedure?
We have a stranded plant procedure that provides directions on how to manage conditions should vehicular traffic into the station be disrupted. We do have earth-moving equipment on site to help us clear any blockages that may result from a landslide, for example, whether it be induced by a seismic event or by a significant weather event. We do have capability of getting materials to the site, as I indicated, by barge, also by helicopter MOUs for bringing equipment in. So we've got, you know, a variety of ways of assuring that we can keep the plant supplied adequately with necessary resources in the event that it should become stranded. I'll profess that I'm not intimately familiar with the stranded plant procedure, but there are provisions to timely restore access to the plant and in parallel have the capabilities of getting people and resources to the plant.
Yeah, I think that's good for now. We may look into that in one of the fact-finding meetings.
I was going to suggest that somewhere along the way in the fact-finding, one of our fact-finding groups may want to look at that and learn more detail. Go ahead.
Okay. What I'd like to turn to now is the continuing industry response. This is what I call the generic or broad-based industry response to the circumstances as we understand them from Fukushima. Collectively, the industry has come together to create an organization with representation from the Electric Power Research Institute, which does a lot of research and development and which will bring its resources to bear to better understand some of the phenomena that occurred at Fukushima and help inform strategies going forward to how to, in terms of mitigating those phenomena or preventing those phenomena. The Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, which is the industry-supported group whose focus is to assure excellence in safety. They are participating in this organization, and the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is an organization which represents the industry principally at the interface with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but also with key stakeholders and members of the public. These organizations have come together to create a way forward document. I'll describe some of the elements of that momentarily, with the objective of ensuring that the lessons learned from Fukushima are identified, well understood, and that response actions are effectively coordinated across the industry where we can take advantage of synergies and commonalities. Go to the next slide, please. This is a picture of what the organization looks like. There's a Fukushima Response Steering Committee that's comprised principally of senior executive industry officials, chief nuclear officers, and senior members in the management of the industry response. And there's really a couple of pieces to this. One piece is improving the integration of the emergency response procedures. The other is improving the capability of the industry to respond to a plant which experiences a significant event, bringing in equipment and other resources. Block number four is strategic communications and outreach, and much of the focus on this is with external stakeholders and maintaining transparency in the programs and processes and changes going forward to assure that those are fully informed with stakeholder input. Block number five is regulatory response, and you can see that's principally shown under NEI, but the industry is fully supporting that with people like people from Diablo Canyon or participating in committees at the interface. The thought there is to assure that we work cooperatively to assure that changes that are proposed and made, in fact, will result in a clear positive impact to nuclear safety. There are some lessons learned from TMI in that regard where perhaps there was some diversion of attention.
Is there going to be cooperation at the international level? A couple of reasons. Europe and Asia are, of course, also trying to develop lessons learned and take action. There may be some best practice there, but also one of the things that Fukushima proves is that nuclear plants operated elsewhere in the world under different regulatory structure can create problems for all nuclear plants everywhere. So communicating best practice in both directions is probably valuable. So to what extent are you aware, is there going to be international collaboration, communication on this area?
There are some things that are going on in that regard. If you look at building block number six up here, one of the objectives of this organization is to support international organizations. In early November, there is a meeting in Paris to talk about Fukushima lessons learned and things that are going on. I do know that the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations is critically examining the stress tests that were performed on the plants in Europe and the applicability and learnings from those tests to plants in the United States. So there is some international agreement. I think it's going to grow as a function of time. Obviously, there are some political issues that are involved here that need to be dealt with.
But I'm really good at asking the question right before you were going to talk about it anyhow. Thanks.
I'll ask Dr. Peters' question in a different way. There is this World Association of Nuclear Operators.
Correct.
To what degree? I don't expect you to know in details, but are they also, is that a mechanism, because they tend to be an association that can overcome any kind of political type of impediments?
The World Association of Nuclear Operators has engaged the international nuclear community. There was what's called a significant operating experience report that was issued for gathering data on mitigating strategies. So they are engaged. I can't speak more authoritatively than that. I do know, for example, that in the United States we've got a NEI published a guidance document, 0612, which provided guidance on how to respond to beyond design basis events involving large explosions and fires. That document was originally classified as security sensitive information. The NRC has declassified that document and disseminated it to other countries that they can look at that information and make informed decisions about how to improve their ability to withstand a significant event.
Might I also offer one piece of advice, which I think, having been engaged in similar things, it's a very poor idea to phrase this as supporting international organizations. It implies that it's not a two-way communication and we're better than they are.
That was not the intent.
That is not, but it's... I guarantee you, for Americans, it's so easy to do that. So I this is one thing I would recommend specifically, is to modify the slide and to communicate with everybody else nationwide. That's not the way to present how the United States is going to engage the international community, because it's counterproductive. And furthermore, we can learn from them just as equally as they can learn from us.
Absolutely. I appreciate the comment.
Yeah, I was going to comment that I myself am going to Argentina at the end of next week, and I'm going to be in India in November and in Armenia in December, and those places couldn't be more different from each other or from us. And I've been doing this for a long, long time, and I am continually amazed at how much insight there is from some of those other practices and activities that is sometimes directly relevant, often not. But it's always interesting, because there are more than one or two ways to skin this cat, and sometimes they have clever ideas which don't effectively make their way here just because of some of these barriers. Now, I know, because I've talked to people in EPRI and in INPO, that they're aware of this too. It's just a question that we all have to keep our eyes open to be sure that we don't inadvertently think that, well, we're Americans and we know.
Okay. The issue on seismic and leveraging that initiative to help us inform actions from Fukushima. Block number six is international organizations, international engagement, and there are activities ongoing in that regard. And then, of course, building block seven is the research and development as more information becomes available from Fukushima, sponsored principally by the Electric Power Research Institute.
To what extent is the technical and R&D work going to be coordinated with NRC-sponsored work? Because they should be also, and actually DOE as well, initiating research in areas that are relevant.
I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sure that the NRC through the Office of Research is going to have significant activities in the national laboratories, and I'm sure there will be some cooperation and sharing of information.
The university professors, you say the word research, and just yeah, it's, anyhow. But,
Bill, just one more, as long as we're sort of stretching the envelope. I don't expect you to know this, but do you happen to know, on the steering committee, is there anyone on the steering committee that's been like a site vice, a nuclear site vice president, or has a
Chip Pardee from Exelon is okay, on the steering committee. Yeah, there are a lot of operating nuclear power plant senior executive experienced people who are on the steering committee.
Wonderful, thank you.
Okay, the near-term actions that the organization focused on initially were to engage with the NRC on reasonable actions to improve safety margins, mindful of some of the lessons from response to the accident at Three Mile Island. We're working closely with the NRC to follow a discipline process on other issues and to integrate Fukushima regulatory response with other ongoing regulatory actions. As I indicated, most notably the generic safety issue on seismic is a good example on that. Strategic goals, and these align pretty much around the seven building blocks. The first, and again, we can't overemphasize the importance of the nuclear workforce continuing to focus on safety and operational excellence. Improving timelines for emergency response capability during station blackout. This is something that we talked about a couple of minutes ago, the importance of integrating our procedures, doing thorough walkdowns and understanding and creating human-friendly connect points for portable equipment. Creating capability for the nuclear industry to respond to a significant event any place in the United States. And that effort has been initiated. There is a survey out to all stations to identify equipment that they may need and commodities they may need from off-site and to try to identify locations for staging this equipment and creating transport capability. Integrating the procedures for emergency response, including Bravo 5, Bravo, the EOPs and the severe accident management guidelines, and looking for ways to enhance command and control on the implementation of those procedures and to deal with events that impact multiple units at a site.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out that this last bullet on integrating the severe accident management and external events response, EDMGs, I think is important because, particularly with EDMGs, since they were developed for security-related events, there was not actually any formal linkage for activating them coming out of a natural disaster-initiated event. And getting that piece worked through, I think, will make them will give us greater confidence that they can be implemented promptly in a time frame that would avoid serious plant damage, and unfortunately ended up happening in Japan.
I would agree that the genesis of those procedures were for events that didn't envision significant natural events, but they are focused on responding to conditions where you have a loss of large areas of the plant. So the applicability for responding to events induced by natural events is there, but clarifying it and integrating it is definitely something that needs to be done. The final strategic goals are to assure that we have adequate margins from protection from external events, and that should be based upon the latest hazards analysis and historical information. I think Lauren's going to talk in a little bit about seismic events and the things that are going on at Diablo Canyon from a seismic standpoint. Spent fuel, pool cooling, and makeup, we talked about that those have to be fully protected, and I'll talk about some of the things that we've done at Diablo Canyon since we last met in that regard. And then primary containment protective strategies that can mitigate post-accident conditions. The focus right now in the industry is on the BWR Mark I and Mark II containments, but there is a recommendation that may extend consideration for containment management beyond those containments.
Now, on the first bullet, on external events, are they limited to seismic and tsunami?
They're limited now. The focus, I don't want to say limited. The focus right now is on external flooding and seismic. But I will tell you that I was on a phone call earlier this week, and our friends in Atlanta are going to be promulgating information. That's correct.
Cooper, so, you know,
there is some increased obvious sensitivity to events that are beyond just external flooding and seismic.
If I may make a comment on Dr. Peterson's question about implementing the extensive damage mitigation guidelines, EDMGs. I think most all of the emergency procedures and others are symptom-based and not cause-based. Mm. So, in other words, just because you had a tsunami or an earthquake doesn't mean you'd want to implement your EDMGs. You'd want to see what the damage is. In other words, what are the symptoms you're trying to deal with, not the cause. Pretty much all the procedures are based that way, aren't they? The emergency procedures and others.
The EOPs are symptom based, yeah. Right? They have you deal mm-hmm. that. You don't mm-hmm. assume that there's a loss of coolant accident. You've got EOP 00, which is reactive tripper safety injection. You respond to that based upon indications that you see. You start making sure that equipment is operating, and then you make informed decisions as to whether mm-hmm. or not you're being successful with the strategy that you're implementing, and go to other procedures or strategies. The SAMGs provide a menu, if you will, of actions that can be taken once you reach 1,200 degrees core exothermocouple temperature, which is indicative of incipient fuel damage. But again, it's not a go see if you got this problem. It's we need to maintain cooling to the steam generators. Do you have a high pressure source of water mm-hmm. available, yes or no? If the answer is no, go do this. If the answer is yes, then go do this. So they're a little bit more deterministic in terms of creating conditions that will allow you to be successful.
Yeah. So I think they were designed that way.
That's correct. Yes.
So just
although when you do have extensive plant damage states, then functions including instrumentation, you have to assume may or may not be available, which is one of the reasons why having some reevaluation of instrumentation for key plant state parameters that relate to, for example, primary inventory and such, that it needs to be checked in the context of extensive plant damage states. On the primary containment protective strategies, I think here it's important to note the large difference between PWRs and BWRs, in the sense that with PWRs, you can remove decay heat using feed and bleed by injecting into steam generators, and therefore you can vent the steam to the atmosphere. And in BWRs, you do not have steam generators. You are forced to, when you inject to do feed and bleed, to vent the steam into containment, which means that you deposit a large amount of energy into the containment. And if your normal cooling heat sink is not available, eventually you have to vent. And the delays in venting and the difficulty in venting that they had in Japan was a major contributing factor to the severity of the accident, which in the case of a PWR would not have been the case. But the flip side is that the reactors, our PWRs currently have seal leakage, lose primary inventory over time, and therefore if you don't have high pressure injection to the primary system, at some point you lose the capability to transfer heat to the steam generators adequately. So could you discuss, I think that there's some plans to replace seals on the pumps so that you'd have low leakage following shutdown, if that's still the case, and if you could discuss a little bit.
It is. The current analyses for the reactor cone pump seals that are Westinghouse reactor cone pump seals that are installed throughout the industry is within a relatively short period of time on a loss of cooling to the seals, you will experience a failure with leakage rates as high as 20 plus gallons per minute per seal. Westinghouse has designed a new stage one seal assembly, which has a polymeric ring in it, which when it reaches approximately 285 degrees, that ring will extend into the gap between the seal piece and the shaft of the reactor coolant pump, closing that gap and limiting leakage to something on the order of less than 1 gallon per minute. Diablo Canyon is engaged with Westinghouse. We have internally made plans to replace the seals on all four reactor coolant pumps on each unit during the next two refueling outages, the one next spring on Unit 1 and then the following one on Unit 2. There is one other station that has installed the seals on one of their units. That's Farley Station. Their experience has been good. I think they've got a fall refueling outage this year, and they're going to install those seals on the second. And I'm in discussions with the other plants that are part of the STARS Alliance, which Diablo Canyon belongs to, the other Westinghouse plants, and they likewise are headed the same direction to minimize inventory loss.
Let me just state that I believe this committee strongly endorses this plant modification and replacing the seals with these low leakage designs. That's a very good idea.
Yes, indeed.
All right, I'd like to shift now to the industry or the NRC response and things that are on the availability of equipment, the maintenance and testing of that equipment, the training of our personnel, and agreements with off-site agencies. Diablo Canyon did respond to that bulletin, as did the rest of the industry, and the NRC is digesting that information. Continuing NRC response, the task force that the NRC formed did create 12 recommendations. I'd like to cover those at a high level and then talk about what's going on with them. The first recommendation up there is to improve the regulatory processes and regulations governing beyond design basis events. The second is to specifically require licensees to re-examine design basis seismic and flooding events. And the longer term enhancements to prevent or mitigate seismically induced fires. That was based on an experience in Japan a few years ago where they had a seismic event that ultimately resulted in a significant transformer fire at a nuclear power plant. Strengthening station blackout mitigation capability beyond what's currently captured in the regulations. Hardened vents for Mark 1 and Mark 2 containments, as we've talked earlier. Identifying insights about hydrogen control and mitigation inside containments. At one point in time, all the pressurized water reactors in the United States were obliged to have hydrogen recombiners in containment. The NRC has backed away from that hard regulatory requirement. I'm confident that will be revisited going forward. Requiring licensees to upgrade design basis seismic and flooding protection provisions. Enhancing the capability to, again, mitigate seismically induced fires and floods, strengthening station blackout mitigation capability at all operating and new reactors. Let's see, we already talked about the Mark 1 and Mark 2, so I think I probably covered all of this. Hydrogen control, yeah, okay. If we go to the next slide, please, Pete. Pursuing EP topics related to decision-making, radiation monitoring, and public education, and then strengthening regulatory oversight of licensee safety performance. So those are kind of the 12 areas of recommendation that came out of the NRC. The staff has reviewed these, and they have made recommendations to the commission regarding the prioritization. Peter, if we go to the next slide, please. There's a couple points I want to make before getting into the prioritization. As part of the communication between the staff and the commissioners, the staff continued to conclude that none of the findings of the task force rise to the level of an imminent hazard to public health and safety. And they acknowledge that their objective in creating new regulatory guidance and requirements has to be to not divert the NRC or the industry focus from other important safety significant issues. So there's a recognition that this is only one of the issues confronting the industry, and it must be treated in a balanced fashion. Three tiers of prioritization have been created. Tier one are those things that that should be started without delay and for which the NRC believes the resources are available to do so. Tier two are recommendations that they want to proceed with, but they may be constrained either by the availability of resources for the tier one recommendations and or there may be some information that has to come from some of the tier one recommendations to better inform the tier two. And then tier three are things that require additional evaluation to confirm that regulatory action is appropriate.
I'd just like to note that in having had the opportunity to observe how the NRC has responded and the work that the 90-day task force performed and then these additional recommendations prioritization, the technical competence and the tremendous performance of the NRC here, I think it's really impressive. to see how they have worked through these issues and identified and prioritized their strategies so that they can be implemented, and have, I think, done a good job of weighting these actions by risk significance. The accident in Japan, when you look at the regulatory system there, I think that there's significant elements that come from a much weaker ability to prioritize activities by risk significance. For example, the regulatory requirement to have no longer than 13-month interval between refueling outages and extended time frame for refueling outages is I think, from risk perspective, just not justified. And it I think it tends to divert resources away from more risk-significant things that could be addressed, and it also, in some sense, creates a false sense of security and complacency that you're doing these things that are so obviously above and beyond. And that goes back to saying that in having evaluated these task force recommendations, I think that they are well organized and weighted towards actions that will substantively address risk associated, have enormous risk reduction benefit, and none of those things were done in Japan. Yeah. Even though the cost of having implemented them would have been trivially small compared to other things that they required through their regulations. And it goes back to being able to prioritize one's efforts by risk significance.
I think Dr. Peterson's remarks are well placed. Furthermore, if I may add, I think after this Fukushima accident, there is a paradigm shift within the NRC as well, within the whole nuclear industry. In the old days, we tend to dismiss severe beyond design basis accident by its unlikelihood of occurrences. Nowadays, I think the landscape has shifted to focusing, never mind what the probabilities are, let us focus on assuming a major beyond design basis event were to occur, what are the cost-effective means of mitigations are. If it only costs the minimum amount of resources to fix a major severe nuclear accident beyond the design basis, let us do it. I think we are observing that trend.
There is obviously the new plant licensing requirements delve into the areas as you described. One of the things the NRC is struggling with currently is what constitutes a standard for adequate protection. I suspect that's going to be changing as a function of time, and will be used to inform some of the decision making going forward on things that need to be done.
Right. I think also that the major attention right now is on mitigation strategies to mitigate the propagation of accident at the plant site. In the longer term, we'll also, I'm sure, begin to review and learn a lot from the perspective of emergency response, particularly off-site actions, and how to make those more efficient and effective, because there's a lot to be learned from what happened in Japan that can feed back into making our strategies for off-site emergency response more risk-informed and effective. And I think that many of the insights we may end up with that will come from examining what happened in Japan in the emergency response area will be counterintuitive. So we need to be prepared for that. It may be that in some places we actually over-prepare. There'll be a lot of debate about, for example, what is the correct radius to have, you know, mm-hmm. defined plans in place. And I think that in some ways it's likely to prove out that you want to have different capabilities at different radii that are weighted by the time scale that you need to be able to respond over. And we may find that our sort of deterministic 10-mile limit is not the best approach. But that stuff I expect will happen in the longer term. The first thing, major attention here really is more towards the plant-specific mitigation, although there's, I guess, some work on the emergency response as well.
There is, and you'll see some of that here shortly. The last area that came out of the staff, the SECI letter that the staff sent the Commission on Prioritizing Actions, were some additional non-Fukushima issues that came to the attention of the staff that they felt inappropriate that at some point in time the NRC examine. The first, with regard to Tier 1, I've tried to categorize those into kind of general areas. The first Tier 1 issue is seismic and flooding. And this is an area where the NRC anticipates initiating action within the next 6 to 8 months, the focus being on developing acceptance criteria for reevaluation of site-specific seismic hazards. Part of that is the generic safety issue 199 to evaluate the application of present-day regulatory guidance for licensing to evaluating flooding hazards at operating reactors. I think recently you've probably become aware that the TVA has identified some hazards that, and TMI has identified some hazards that previously were not characterized, and they've had to take actions to address those. There'll be two 50-54 Foxtrot letters coming requesting information, which is a way of NRC, the way the NRC uses to encourage people to do things, to request a reevaluation of site-specific seismic hazards using the methodology that's agreed upon coming out of the generic safety issue, and identify actions that have been taken or are planned to address plant-specific vulnerabilities. And I think Diablo Canyon is really well postured with regard to this because of the long-term seismic program. And again, Lauren's going to be talking about that in the next presentation. And then the second 50-54 F letter will essentially do the same thing with regard to flooding and dealing with flooding hazards and remediation of flooding hazards. And then finally, there will be a 50-54 F letter again in the same time frame for seismic and flood protection walkdowns to identify the configuration of the plant and changes that are necessary for mitigating any vulnerability. Okay, the second area being addressed by the Tier 1 recommendations are station blackout mitigation for design and beyond design basis events. Rulemaking will be coming. That will take somewhere in the vicinity of 4 years, but there's going to be significant activity in between with stakeholder involvement on station blackout. And in parallel with that, for the beyond design basis, there will be an order that will be issued, we're anticipating, sometime in the next 6 to 8 months regarding protection of equipment used to satisfy the requirements of the regulation that's shown there, 10 CFR 5054 Hotel 2. That regulation basically codified the direction that the NRC had provided to the industry following the events of 9/11 to be prepared to deal with events that involve large-scale fires or explosions at plants. And there's really two pieces to that. One is to make sure that equipment will survive natural events, and the second is to assure that sufficient equipment is available to handle simultaneous events on all of the units at a particular plant. So that is forthcoming.
Bill?
Yes, sir.
On this question of station blackout, some equipment is more important than others. And in the case of Fukushima, on units 2 and 3, the steam-driven injection pumps, mm-hmm. the RICSI pumps, were clearly the most important pieces of equipment they had from the perspective of delaying the onset of core damage.
Correct.
The reasons that the steam-driven, turbine-driven pumps ultimately failed, at least one of them, I believe, was due to depletion of battery power. And I'm not sure why battery power was needed to keep that pump running. And the other one, I'm not completely sure either. But I'd like to know, in the case of Diablo Canyon, your steam turbine-driven aux feed water pump plays the same sort of role.
It can be operated manually, locally, without DC power.
So in the case of that pump, you have the capacity to get water into the steam generators, even if you don't have battery power, except for flashlights. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. Yes.
Per, I can explain. In Japan, there was a manual capability that was inaccessible because of the radioactivity. Afterwards. Early on,
but this was prior to.
That's right. So prior, there's a mystery as to why it failed. It's just a plain mystery, okay?
That's something that, admittedly,
this is secondhand to me, but that was my understanding.
Yeah. With respect to, of course, right now it remains the priority to respond to the accident in Japan in ways to mitigate the consequences. But the forensics of trying to determine why some things failed, particularly these pumps, I think, is really important to make sure that there's not some common problem.
Yes, sir.
Because those pumps play a very important role under prolonged station blackout.
Yes, indeed. You know, my understanding is most of the steam turbine driven pump are dependent on DC power, because either at the inlet or the outlet there's a control valve, either the throttle or the flow, dependent on DC power. Once that is depleted, then manual intervention is required.
But Bill's statement is that in the case of the pumps for Oxfeed water for Diablo Canyon, that battery power is not required. They can be operated manually. So
it's my understanding, they can be operated manually locally, and the valves can be operated manually. Now, as was indicated by Dr. Budnitz, we would be less likely to experience challenging environmental events for operators to operate that equipment just because of the location of the plant. Now, having said that, as we continue our exploration of station blackout mitigation in Diablo Canyon, we are looking at environmental conditions, for example, in the rooms that contain the Terry turbines, to make sure that we can maintain those environmental conditions that will allow people to be in there and operate those pumps. So we are factoring into conditions which can occur as the event is extended.
Yeah. Because this issue was explored by one of my fact-finding trips to the plant. Yeah, and what is said here is certainly correct, but the normal mode of operation is DC power dependent, mm-hmm. and there's a manual intervention mode so that if DC power is lost, one can go down there and crank it open or make it stay open.
That's good. That is good. Okay. Actually, I would go back. I think another issue for technical clarification, The steam-driven turbines in BWRs, the steam has to vent back into containment.
That's right.
That's a big difference on terms of reliability. You have no back pressure problem.
Back into the...
Okay, so in fact, I think on a PWR, you can see why manual operation is much easier.
Yeah.
The point is that the steam that is coming out of a BWR, because it could be contaminated with radioactivity and it's being used to drive this pump, it has to be sent back into containment to be condensed in the suppression pool.
BWR containment venting, Mark 1 and Mark 2, we've talked a little bit about that. The focus currently is on boiling water reactors, but as you'll see, there's a Tier 3 recommendation to look beyond boiling water reactors and containments of different designs. The fourth area is enhancing spent fuel pool instrumentation, and that will involve an order to provide reliable spent fuel pool instrumentation, including parameters to be monitored and wear and qualifications for instrumentation. There's still discussion obviously going on between the industry and the NRC regarding what those requirements should look like.
In this area, I would recommend considering installing a bubbler tube. It's a very simple piece of instrumentation that just consists of a pre-installed tube that dips down to somewhere near the bottom of the pool. And by injecting compressed air or instrument air or nitrogen, the pressure required to get a small but continuous flow of gas tells you what the water level is. And the other thing is that you can do that manually with bottled gas with a manual gauge, without any electrical power beyond the flashlight needed to look at the pressure gauges. I had the chance to visit the Millstone Unit 1 plant 2 weeks after the Fukushima accident, because it's essentially almost exact copy of Fukushima Unit 1. And as we were going around, it's decommissioned now, so they have temporary lighting. And one of the things that strikes you when you're doing that, and you go in and you look at the racks of pressure gauges that are used to measure the pressures in the primary system and the containment, the Japanese operators that were doing that work by flashlight in that environment, in that building, taking those readings manually, are heroes. It was very impressive. But I would look seriously at installing bubbler tube, because it's extraordinarily robust and it requires no electrical power. you can manually read level.
I jotted that down. Thank you. Good recommendation. Next slide, Pete. Fifth Tier 1 strategy is strengthening and integrating emergency response procedures. We've talked about this already. The NRC is proposing to proceed with an advance notice of rulemaking. This will occur over a period of what's currently estimated to be about 4 years, but there will be interim actions with heavy reliance on the owners' groups to improve these procedures and integrate them. With regard to emergency plans, we talked a little bit about those earlier. There was a question asked about that. We anticipate two 5054F letters. One is to request a staffing study to determine whether the staffing levels are adequate to respond to a multi-unit event, and then request for enhancements needed to power communications equipment for prolonged station blackout. And we are currently working on an evaluation of this, which presupposes a blackout extending in a 25-mile radius around the plant, affecting all normal communications on-site and off-site. All right, Tier 2 recommendations. So there's six Tier 1 recommendations. There's two areas with Tier 2 recommendations. And again, they're both preceded by the receipt of additional technical information from Fukushima. In the first case, to engage in rulemaking on reliable spent fuel pool instrumentation and makeup capabilities. This is reflective of the fact that we still don't fully understand what happened in the spent fuel pools at Fukushima, and there may be additional information that's forthcoming that will cause us to take actions beyond what we learned from Tier 1. And then the second is emergency plans, again, Tier 2, and again, this is predicated on availability of staff. To order changes to emergency planning capability to do, and this is some of the offsite stuff that you were talking about, multi-unit dose projection, multi-unit prolonged station blackout exercise scenarios, acquisition, training and drilling on identification and acquisition of offsite resources, and making sure that we have sufficient equipment, facilities, and personnel for dealing with multi-unit events. Tier 3 recommendations, there are six of them. These are still under deliberation to determine whether or not the conditions that led to the recommendations warrant regulatory action. Periodic confirmation of seismic and flooding hazards. And this is kind of a, we do it now to find out what we know now and make changes, but do we need to do it again in 10 years? So there's deliberation going on that. Enhancements to mitigate seismically induced fires and floods, again, based upon what additional learnings from Fukushima. Hardened vents for other containment designs. This is what I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that there will be some consideration given to that. Revisiting hydrogen control. I believe that the emphasis on this particular issue has declined somewhat based upon a better understanding of what did not happen in the spent fuel pools at Fukushima. And then emergency preparedness enhancements, again, you can see with the focus on station blackout and multi-unit events. So that's going to be an evolving target over an extended period of time. Tier 3 recommendations also include enhancing the emergency response data system capability. What that system is it's basically a data link between plant computers at individual stations and the NRC headquarters incident response.
Look at external event phenomena like earthquakes and tsunamis, there's some probability distribution as to what the severity might be.
Correct.
And the nature, the specific nature of how, because there's not any single number that describes the severity of an earthquake in particular. It's really the spectrum, and you can have energy concentrated at some specific frequency. If that happens to align with resonances, you can get damage even at a lower earthquake magnitude. So what that tells us is that when you get out to lower frequency events, it's very difficult for us to predict what is the real shape of the tail and whether there might be a surprise out in the lower frequency range that would cause us would cause the Gaussian, the simplistic understanding of what a tail might look like to be radically incorrect. The neat thing about defense in depth is that it doesn't care. In other words, you have put on mitigation strategies that are independent of the shape of that tail. And that gives you strong safety even when you're dealing with these types of uncertainties. And particularly for external events, the development of these mitigation methods that allow you to restore safety functions when something has happened that you couldn't fully have anticipated or didn't fully anticipate is the best way to improve the resilience. And that's why this defense in depth framework is something that I think we will think about it in a much different way going forward post-Fukushima than we did pre-Fukushima.
I would agree, and one of the initiatives that I've been asked to undertake has to deal with enterprise risk management at Diablo Canyon. Historically, we've looked at risk due to an extended shutdown, but that definition has been expanded to potential core damaging events and mitigating activities from a more deterministic basis. Next slide, please, Pete. Okay, there are some additional activities or initiatives that the NRC has taken under consideration as it's worked through the task force process. Some of these have come as a result of stakeholder involvement or practices elsewhere in the world, such as filtration of containment vents. That's a pretty common practice in Europe, where they have charcoal and or other technology filters on their containment vents. Instrumentation for seismic monitoring, which was a recent learning coming out of the North Anna plant when they lost their seismic instrumentation when offsite power went away, and so they were not able to promptly characterize the significance of the event.
I think North Anna has proven that it's really expensive not to have adequate instrumentation, because they're going to be down significantly longer trying to reconstruct what had happened and provide a basis for arguing for restart because they had antiquated seismic instrumentation. I'm pretty sure all plants that are intelligent are going to upgrade their seismic instrumentation based on the lessons learned from North Anna.
Absolutely. The basis for emergency planning zone size, which was a topic, Dr. Peterson, that you mentioned earlier, will be revisited. There's an initiative out there, a recommendation to consider pre-staging potassium iodide beyond the 10-mile EPZ. There's ongoing dialogue, particularly in the Senate, on transfer of spent fuel to dry cask storage and accelerating the movement of fuel, spent fuel out of spent fuel pools. And there's renewed interest, both on the part of the NRC and INPO, on scenarios leading to loss of the ultimate heat sink.
Was there any evidence from Fukushima that there were problems with getting potassium iodide where it was needed that would say that pre-staging is important?
I'm unaware of any, but that doesn't mean there wasn't. That just means I'm unaware of it, so I can't speak authoritatively on that.
No, that was okay.
Okay, I'd like to turn now to some actions that have been taken at Diablo Canyon to this point in time and then some additional actions that we're engaged in. As I indicated earlier, we've walked on and validated our procedures and equipment for mitigating design basis events to confirm that we do, in fact, have a viable capability. We have gone through and confirmed the maintenance and surveillance of equipment for mitigating beyond design basis events. There may be some changes forthcoming there. Again, the industry is comparing strategies at the plants from across the country to see if there's ways to optimize those approaches. We did confirm our training on beyond design basis events was current, but we have done some enhancements to that training, and we have re-performed or revitalized or redone some of that training with operations people and emergency response organization people. We've confirmed and strengthened agreements with off-site agencies for support to Diablo Canyon. I talked about the memorandum of understanding with barging fuel and helicopter memorandum of understanding to make sure that we have access to supplies. We have provided refresher training to operating and emergency response organization staff for implementing the beyond design basis procedure. We've confirmed the application of shutdown safety principles and standards to the spent fuel pool and equipment, and we have identified additional equipment needed for mitigating beyond design basis events in both units. That's a bit of a moving target as we better understand what's happening at Fukushima and we develop new equipment needs. That will likely change, but we have at least gone through and said, okay, here's what we have for one unit. We need to at least double it and perhaps go beyond for two units. So we've identified that equipment list.
On the heat-up calculations, a much more substantial amount of water sloshed out of the pools at Fukushima than had been anticipated. And so I think that in looking at spent fuel pool heat up, one needs to look at a range of inventory loss that might be initiated by a seismic event. And then this also points to the importance of having a post-seismic event inspection procedures that include checking water level and inspecting the leak chases to see if there's any leaks, because you need to also be able to take into account if a leak has occurred, you'd like to have
potentially even just tables in place that say, this leak rate, now here's how much time I have.
We have an outstanding action in the corrective action program to modify our post-earthquake procedure to get people out there to look specifically at inventory and look at the leak chase to see if there's any leakage coming from this.
Right. I'd recommend to couple that together with this set of calculations so that you can either have a computer program or a set of tables that would allow you, whatever you find in the post-seismic inspection, you can rapidly figure out what are the time scales that you have available in order to take corrective action. And in the case of Fukushima, if that ability had existed, they would have not diverted a lot of resources to trying to spray water into the spent fuel pools. And they would have focused more on the reactors, because in retrospect, we know that the pools were never really at risk. But there is no way to measure water inventory, and there was enormous amount of uncertainty as to the status, both in terms of leakage and initial losses. And important resources were diverted away from things that could have been more beneficial in reducing risk.
That's a good point. It not only provides you the opportunity to assess the conditions and respond to the spent fuel pool, it also informs decisions about whether or not you need to respond to the spent fuel pool. So that's a very good point. Okay, Pete, the next slide, please. You have a number of actions in progress that I wanted to report on. We are proceeding, as we discussed earlier, with a project to replace reactor coolant pump seals with a low leakage design. We have a representative actively participating in the industry working group that I talked about earlier. And we're populating interface committees with NEI and the NRC on some of the near-term actions, as well with people from Diablo Canyon. We're actively evaluating actions to improve our ability to cope with station blackout, communication enhancements for station blackout. We talked about the 25-mile radius and the assumptions there in creating backup communication capability. We're enhancing our capability to restart diesel generators following a protracted station blackout, and we're evaluating commodity needs for a prolonged station event. And we'll continue to move forward on all of these fronts. So that completes my presentation. If you have questions, I'll be more than happy to try to answer them.
I have one additional comment. We will be looking more at emergency protection. And I think that there's a very important philosophical point or question that we need to raise, which is some recommendations will be to increase the radius of pre-deployed planning and other types of capabilities and sort of a pre-staging. The alternative approach is to improve our capability to deliver resources to an area that needs them and to take action rapidly. And I think from a societal perspective, improving our capacity to put resources, move resources where they're needed, is a much better strategy than one that tries to pre-deploy them where you think they might be needed in advance. Because the flexibility that you get to respond to unanticipated weather patterns and other things is increased. And then the other thing is that these are also resources and capabilities that can be made available for other types of natural disasters and security events. And if they've been designed to be flexible and mobile, they're much more beneficial for those alternative needs than something that has been hard, is installed and fixed in space. So when we start to get into these discussions about, for example, what does the EPZ radius need to be, I think it's really important for us to also have a discussion as to what do we mean by EP and how do we get the biggest risk benefit from the investment that we make. Because my concern is that we may end up getting ratcheted into a whole bunch of we made extensive use of U.S. capabilities for radiation detection and monitoring and emergency response that have been developed through the Department of Energy for security-related nuclear incidents where you can't predict where they might happen. And that meant that we had the capacity to actually deliver those capabilities into Japan. Mm-hmm. And having a more flexible capability to respond events, I think, is the best national strategy. Mm-hmm.
And that goes back to the fact that I don't think, for example, the question of whether you need to extend where you put potassium iodine out to a larger radius may not be the right strategy. The ability to get potassium iodine where it's needed in time and have the ability to get it distributed regardless of where it might be needed may be the better national investment.
Comments, Dr. Butness?
Yeah, I had one brief comment on his, and then I have my own comment. At the time of the Three Mile Island accident, which is March of 1979, a good long time ago, military assets were called in immediately, and there was no issue with that, and it worked just great. I remember full well I was in the Incident Response Center at TMI for the first couple of weeks, and that was just a really wonderful response, and that would happen again, as it did here with military assets helping the Japanese. The main thing there, and I know you've taken action along these lines already, and all the plants have to, is just make sure that they've identified and make those communication links so that there's a telephone number to call and a backup for that. And I know you've done that, so that's good. And I want to not only commend what I've seen so far, but to ask if you guys, as you're pushing that further to really make those firm arrangements, make sure that everybody else knows what you've done, because if you're an industry leader in this regard, that would be a big help to all the other plants.
Okay. All right.
So now I have a second, completely different point. Has to do with the two-unit problem. The problem that you get in trouble either with both units from the same event,
mm-hmm.
or you get in trouble with one unit and the other unit's there to help without compromising its safety, too.
Mm-hmm.
For the last several months, how long has it been? We've been looking at your capabilities there, and we've been generally pleased with what you have and what you've done. Great. The suggestion is even more reinforced here. To the extent that your capabilities are already stronger than some other two-unit or three-unit stations, and I believe they are, to the extent that that you can provide leadership in that area for other stations, that's a terrific thing. Because I am doing, in my other life, some work for other places that don't have near what you have already. Not that yours is enough yet. There's still more to do, and you know that. So it seems to me that working together, all the stations have to learn from the ones that are out in front, even though the ones out in front are still doing more. And if you're out in front, that's great. I want to urge Diablo Canyon to make sure that the sort of things you're doing are known to everybody, and that they can learn from you where it's important. Now, how did this come about? Well, first of all, because this is a seismic site. So going all the way back, this site, long before you were here and I was here, long before Lauren was here, long before any of us were here, the fact that those earthquakes affect both reactors was known from the beginning. And so there were certain things that were done way, way back at the very beginning, which were and remain stronger than in some other stations.
In that regard, one of the things that we are doing is coordinating the activities of the STARS plants and other plants beyond the STARS plants in response to Fukushima. When I say coordinating, I conduct weekly phone calls, conference calls. I've got one in 13 minutes.
Exchanging information.
Exchanging information, sharing good ideas, identifying.
Is that a hint?
No, that, trust me, it's not.
It should be.
It wasn't. At least it wasn't intended to be. What it was intended to do is communicate that we are actively engaged with a large portion of the rest of the industry, sharing our learnings and sharing and learning from what they are learning and the things that they are doing. So we are not operating in isolation here. I wanted to assure you of that.
Yeah, and part of what I was saying just here is if the public, who are some of them in front of us and some of them watching, over the airwaves, should know that this cooperation is going on and that it is really important that, you know, we say two heads are better than one. You bet. And there's a whole lot of wisdom out there that we can take advantage of.
I appreciate the counsel. Thank you.
I'd like to add to Dr. Butness and Dr. Peterson's remark by saying all the comparison between what the Able Cannon with Fukushima, it's well thought of, and it is a good thing to do, the event. And there are many that is not within the category of seismic event and tsunami. I think it's now time for all of us in this business, in the nuclear reactor safety business and operation business, to think about, let us do not dismiss events purely based on probability estimates, on how unlikely they were estimated to be, because we were, frankly, not on the mark on some of the events that previously we thought would be extremely unlikely to happen. For example, station blackout was considered extremely unlikely to happen. Multiple events involving multiple reactors were considered extremely unlikely to happen. A spent fuel pool accident was considered extremely unlikely to happen. And to everybody's disappointment, they happen. Therefore, my urging is, it's time for us to consider beyond design basis accident to see if there are any cost-effective measures that involve perhaps the minimum amount of resources, perhaps involve substantial amount of resources, but if it's cost-effective for you to mitigate a major, major event, perhaps let's consider them and see where we go. Now, as I indicated earlier to you, I think we are already doing that. I just want to reinforce my message. Let us continue in that direction. And that's my remark.
I agree. I think Peter has stated things very well. This is the correct direction to go, and I think it is the direction that we are going.
Right. If no more remarks from the committee members, there's one from Mr. Wardell.
Following up somewhat on Dr. Budnitz's comments, and notwithstanding Dr. Lamb's, as I take a practical, pragmatic look at Diablo Canyon and its capabilities versus Fukushima and beyond design basis events, no matter what they are, even looking at Diablo's capabilities as we have for many years on this committee, I don't want to sound complacent, but I do have a good feeling about the strength of Diablo to withstand and mitigate these events. It's only strengthened since the B5B extreme damage mitigation guidelines and equipment that's been put in place, portable backup equipment. The list you just went over, Bill, further substantiates that view. So I'm not saying we're there. I'm just saying I have a fairly comfortable feeling that Diablo is very robust and very capable of withstanding beyond design basis events. With that statement, I would ask you, in a pragmatic sense, what do you see are the big ticket items that Diablo Canyon needs to pursue to satisfy all these requirements for Fukushima? Now, an example might be a station blackout. I don't know. It seems to me that would be a biggie for Diablo. Others, emergency planning, to me, you've got a pretty sound emergency planning process, not to mention that you have an 18 to 23-mile emergency planning zone as opposed to a 10-mile. And further, you have a 50-mile ingestion pathway zone already established and practiced. So with some of those things and the backup components and processes you have, I just wonder, in a pragmatic, practical sense, what do you think needs to happen? Now, I know more is going to happen than that, but
there are a number of things that are under consideration. From a deterministic standpoint.
Yeah, deterministic.
One of the things that I'm pursuing is RCS makeup capability under blackout conditions from engine-driven charging pump capability. We've identified that there are some viable commercial things out there. We're going to have to evaluate the feasibility of doing that.
Even with the new reactor coolant pump seals?
Even with the new reactor coolant pump seals. As you indicated, one of the vulnerabilities of a PWR is the potential for inventory loss and the fact that decay removal is from the secondary plant principally. So there's a need for ability to manage the primary inventory better perhaps than currently exists. From an emergency planning standpoint, and this isn't just Diablo Canyon, I think more thought needs to be given about the fragility of the infrastructure for things like meteorological monitoring towers and field monitoring and those kinds of things, and whether or not enhancements need to be made there. I don't know that they do, but we need to ask and answer questions like that. Communications capability. You know, I've lived through 5 hurricanes in Florida when I was there. And working for Florida Power and Light, and one of the things you realize is that almost immediately all the cell phones go away because either the infrastructure is damaged.
2 minutes ago, just within the last couple of weeks, I had occasion to review a different plan, completely not Diablo, on the following question. It had to do with the seismic robustness of their capability for makeup after an earthquake. And this particular approach was that rather than assure that makeup was seismically robust, they were going to be absolutely assure that it was very strong, that SI was very strong, high pressure safety injection, which produces way more water rather than just the makeup. And you imagine if you have a very small thing, makeup is what what you'd use, and then the much more capability. And so they were giving up on trying to make this other thing robust. And I myself personally rebelled against that. Said, "Wait up! We want both of those things robust." And they said, "No, the one is sufficient." I'm not arguing the case here. That's somebody else. But I was pleased when you just said that you want to be sure that the makeup system also is as robust as you need.
Right. It's a belt and suspenders approach.
Yeah,
right? If there are cost-effective ways of doing those things, of addressing those vulnerabilities, then common sense dictates that you pursue those paths.
I mean, you don't want to just have SI if you can have the other thing. I mean, I don't have to finish the sentence.
Yeah.
Right. Let me thank our speaker for a very comprehensive review.
Thank you.
And they're very informative. And let me now take the opportunity to welcome Mr. Lawrence Sharp, the senior director of technical services from PG&E. Before I turn the podium over to Mr. Sharp, let me say Mr. Sharp is one of the most senior managers on site at Diablo, and perhaps we'll do things a little differently this time. Let me also introduce Mr. P. Bellison. He is the PG&E liaison to the committee. As you know, the committee's needs are continuous and complicated, and Mr. Bellison has been most effective in his interaction with the committee. And thank you. Now, I think since Fukushima event is of tremendous public interest, I think I would like to ask, before I turn the podium over to Mr. Sharp, I'd like to ask for public comments at this time on Fukushima. Do anybody have any objection to what we are doing? Okay. Then the presentation is fresh on everybody's memory. So any member of the public, please come forward to provide your comments on this particular subject. Please introduce yourself, Ms. Lewis.
I'm Sherry Lewis, and I've listened to it as well as I could, and I have a few questions. One is, you mentioned in passing the zirconium cladding, and I have read somewhere that it might be a better idea to use a different metal than that, because that is susceptible to, when it's hit with steam, then you have the hydrogen buildup. Is there any other type of material that could be used instead of the zirconium, which leads to zircalloy?
Let's run through, get the list of questions, and then...
One.
Yeah.
On slide number 4, you don't need to show it. Why did the containment venting fail in Japan? I have a question about that. Well, that's the question. And then in slides 12 and 13, you talk about there's a margin for protection from external events, and on the next page, beyond design basis, natural phenomena. I want you to bring in terrorism as well, not just have it be natural phenomena, but acts of people as well. And in discussing on slide 18 that the NRC is doing a good job and coming up with the 12 requirements, I would ask that you look at some of the requirements presented by the Physicians for Social Responsibility. They have come up with their own set of guidelines that I would like you to consider. I don't have them in front of me, so I can't mention them. Mm-hmm. But Physicians for Social Responsibility, a Nobel Prize winning, 1985, I think, group, has some good guidelines I'd like you to consider, mm-hmm. as well as what the NRC said. Those are my questions.
I think we can start answering some of those from here. About fuel. There is an advanced fuel research program underway, but it takes a long time to reach fruition. The search for a light water reactor fuel that didn't use metal cladding that could oxidize has been underway for a couple of decades, and there hasn't yet appeared a fuel out of that research program that meets all the operational requirements.
Enclosed because they did not have access to power. And also they had a great deal of difficulty with instrumentation to understand the state of the plant. And then finally, the decision-making process for containment venting was not at the plant, but instead involved a long loop that went all the way through the government and the Prime Minister's office, and that also contributed to the delays. With respect to security, As I'd mentioned yesterday, this committee is not composed to be able to evaluate security risks for the plant. That requires access to safeguards information, which we can't be divulged in a public setting in any case. And so, we do not take on evaluation of the security of the plant because we don't have a credible capability to do so, nor is it a part of our charter. That doesn't mean that it's not important, but it falls outside the scope of what we can do legitimately as a committee in terms of evaluation. We do evaluate all security modifications that are made at the plant with respect to whether they might affect the operational safety, but we don't evaluate the effectiveness of the security because that would, for example, require for us to be briefed on and knowledgeable about the design basis threats that the plant is intended to defend itself against, and that is sensitive information. So in general, that's the reason why you won't see in our forum security being covered. It falls outside the scope of what we can do, and anything that we would say would not have credibility anyhow.
And if I may add, Dr. Peterson, the security access is based on the need to know, and I believe our legal counsel's office may need to render a legal opinion on that aspect. We have not asked our legal counsel's office to consider that issue yet, but that's an additional barrier.
Right.
To the committee to pursue this type of inquiry.
We actually have two members. We have the appropriate security clearances and other things to be able to do that, but I don't think that within the context of what the committee does that we have the capability nor the charter to be able to do so. And I think it would damage our credibility if we were to veer off into areas where we clearly don't have competence to render opinions. And then finally, I thank you for pointing us towards the materials from the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I'd like us to take an action to review those and act on them appropriately.
Right. And if I also may add, the security issue, perhaps, as you are well aware, as a member of the Premier Internet Intervention Group Mothers for Peace, there is a separate avenue for you to pursue, which is to go in front of the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission, go through the 10 CFR 5052 petition process, which is a long and elaborate process for public initiative for the commission to consider, if that would be helpful information to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
If I could make a couple points.
Sure.
First, zirconium cladding, or zircaloy, as you mentioned, is correct, has been chosen and used by the nuclear industry for decades. for various reasons. It's great under normal operating conditions. It's good under accident and upset conditions. Now, you commented that it creates hydrogen with steam. Yes, but only at elevated temperatures. At normal operating or even accident conditions, it's very limited. However, you'd have to have very, very high temperatures to get any kind of a large reaction. Secondly, and let me ask my colleagues, doesn't the BWR fuel have stainless steel cladding?
No. Many decades ago.
Not anymore.
Is there plenty as well?
There was some. In fact, there's some spent fuel destined someday for Yucca Mountain or some other place like that, but it's been superseded long ago.
They've converted, okay.
Stainless steel had some really nice operating conditions, but they just had a heck of a time tracking down leakers, and it was abandoned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it also performs very poorly under neutron irradiation. So overall, zirconium is a superior from the perspective of performance and safety. But silicon carbide is being worked on aggressively right now because it has outstanding stability under irradiation, and because it's ceramic, it is very, very robust. But that's still in R&D stage.
The other comment I would make on terrorism, and not to contradict what any of the members have said, which is true. Now, as a committee, we can't, terrorism is not within our scope, but the large spread fires and floods are within our scope, and we found that those procedures and those equipments and the training has been quite adequate to address those items.
If you have, now I don't know about these particular reactors. They're pressure water reactors, isn't that the case?
These are Diablo Canyon's pressure water.
Yeah. Is there any strange? Is there a chance that something could blow up from the containment and have a projectile that then focuses on the dry cast storage area? Well, I mean, it's pretty far-fetched.
To answer that, that goes from the plant up to the dry cast storage area?
Yeah, well, I mean, that gets around terrorism with the same thing happening.
Well, I'll put it this way. The only conceivable missiles would be from the turbine spinning over speed, and that's been analyzed and found to be acceptable. Plus, I'm not sure a missile could go from the turbine building way up that hill and hit a cast directly. Possible, I suppose, but not very reasonable. Anything within the containment, as you asked, there are several missile barriers, one thick concrete around the reactor itself and reactor coolant pumps, a missile shield outside of that, and, of course, a 3-foot-thick containment structure itself, plus the distance up the hill from the reactor building to the dry cast storage area. So pretty improbable, very improbable in my opinion.
Beyond design basis.
Beyond design way basis. Beyond but not only beyond basis. Design basis, but way, way beyond design
right,
basis.
Right, I understand. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Any member of the public would like to address the committee? Please approach the podium and introduce yourself.
Chair and committee members, my name is Robert Lewin. I'm the CAL FIRE Unit Chief, which also makes me the San Luis Obispo County Fire Chief here in San Luis Obispo. And, of course, therefore, we have jurisdiction around the nuclear power plant. I'm glad to say that we have a good relationship with PG&E, and specifically Diablo Canyon. We train regularly, and we do a lot of planning with the plant. We have an annual memorandum of understanding that we update and look at each year. We have a good relationship with the PG&E Fire Brigade. I'm glad to say that my professional opinion is they're a first-rate fire department. But I think there are a lot of lessons to learn from Fukushima. I'm as eager as I know you are to find out what those lessons are, specifically what those lessons are for first responders. In the past, we didn't consider that we may be responsible as firefighters to have to participate in trying to cool down the plant or cool down spent fuel. I think the lessons learned that I understand from Fukushima is that's now a possibility. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I want to, a couple of questions is that I have to ask myself as well as ask PG&E and frankly the entire nuclear industry is, are we currently training on the right things? Are we putting our energies into the right training exercises. Should the training now involve cooling methods? Should we physically be laying hose lines from heat sinks such as the ocean or the reservoirs to refine cooling material onto the reactors or onto the spent fuel? Are our communication systems robust enough to withstand natural disasters? We have worked over the years over and over again, I assure you, to make sure that our communication systems are improved, and they are better than they used to be. They are better because of the lessons learned from 9/11, but I fear to say that they're not probably where they need to be, and there are some things that we can do, and I know that at PG&E recognizes this as well. Do we need to train on how to do safe rotations and how to order resources such as firefighters, law enforcement, equipment, and other sorts of resources and be able to safely rotate those people during an emergency response at the plant? As a 33-year veteran of the fire service, specifically lots of years on wildland fires, we have to sustain operations for many, many weeks on one particular event. We have to every day brief and rotate those resources on and off the line. And the same obviously would occur if we have a sustained operation at a nuclear power plant. And are we prepared to do that? And I can say that we've never trained for that. We've trained often for the one-day scenario where we, during those drills, were successful and we all go home after the drill. But it's clear that one of the lessons learned from Fukushima is that we may have to have sustained operations for multiple days or even multiple weeks or months. That are required training, NRC requirements, involve a lot of actions that the fire department's responsible for off-site needs during a radiation incident. Some of those might be in conflict for what we're now required to do at the plant. If I have to put my emphasis into a response to the plant, I may not be able to have resources available to respond off-site in the manner that was expected of us. I want to say that I personally am not going to be satisfied until I have physically had my people train on performing those necessary exercises that will ensure we are able to do what we need to do at the plant. If that means laying hose, I want my people to physically get out there and lay hose with the fire department at the plant so that I can sleep at night knowing that not only do I understand that I might be able to, or that in a tabletop exercise we think we can, I want to know that we can by actually doing it. PG&E is supportive of this idea. I'm looking forward to actually doing it with them. We just need to put it into action. We need to figure out what that actually is. There are things that we're going to have to look at. I appreciated some of your questions and comments about some of the needs out there in this new world. Some of those needs are a relook at what type of training we need to do. We need to look and see if our EOC is still adequate under the current situation. The EOC that we currently use, the Emergency Operations Center, that the county currently has, was designed in the late 70s, 80s, early 80s. It may be time to expand that EOC to meet current conditions. We do need to look at the improved communication systems. And we need to figure out how we're going to plan for a sustained response to the plant. And I certainly am available for questions.
Well, Chief, thank you for your very thoughtful comments. Before I ask our committee members reply, let me just make sure our legal counsel's office that the fire chief's remark will be accurately reflected in our meeting's minutes.
Yes, yes, we will certainly do that.
Okay, and then Dr. Butness, would you care to respond? And Dr. Peterson?
This was terrific. I've just concluded that we come here about once a month, and we call them fact-finding trips, and on either the next one or the one after, or whenever it is, sometime soon, I think we're going to want to come and talk to you together with the PG&E counterparts with whom you deal.
to see if we can learn some more so that we can make an accurate assessment of our own, because we can then report about it. I mean, our remit here is to review the safety and report about it to the people of California, and this is an area that I think we probably haven't looked at as much as we should. So that's, I just want to tell you that if you expect a call from us, along with working with our PG&E counterparts to make sure that we've integrated, that's probably something we want to do, and we've just caucused in the last minute and agreed to that. Secondly, my top-of-the-head notion is that the most important thing you and your people have to do is the stuff that you do. I assume you agree with that. You're trained to, and your role is to, do things that are different than what the people on the plant do. And if you agree with that, then we can use that as a basis for the next comment, which is that, that said, and everybody agrees with that, it is obvious that whatever training or plans are necessary so that together you and the on-site fire people can work together best, whatever's there to do, let's try to identify that. And with the hindsight of what happened, not only here but other places, take advantage of that hindsight to look forward to making that interaction best. I actually have a particular incident that happened to me that I can relay about this. I was a graduate student in the 60s at the Cambridge Electron Accelerator in Cambridge, Mass. And it had a huge explosion. It was the highest energy electron accelerator in the world. It had a huge explosion, which destroyed the building. Cambridge Fire Department came. It was in the middle of the night, 4 in the morning. I lived a block from there, and I was the first physicist on site, because I was a block from there, and I was there in 3 minutes. They wouldn't go inside because they were afraid of the radioactivity. Fair enough. And hadn't been trained about it. Within 3 months, the Cambridge Fire Department had the training which they lacked before. And that was a lesson learned. The entire AEC of the time, Atomic Energy Commission at the time, learned that lesson from that event and made sure that all of the AEC sites, now the Department of Energy sites, Livermore and Los Alamos and Oak Ridge and Brookhaven and so on, that was overcome. And that's an example of having an event that taught you something that you should have thought of before but didn't think.
We're brought in to assist in the emergency response at the plant site. And for severe external events, security-related or from natural disasters, that could quite plausibly be the case at a nuclear plant in the United States. And so I think better coordination and training in these areas is something that would be wise to pursue. There are some additional reasons why that type of planning in advance would be valuable. The access to the site to perform this type of work involves security screening, and if preparations have not been made in advance, that could impede the ability of off-site responders to assist if they were needed, and so that's something that needs to be worked through. And then finally, I think that there would be substantive benefits for experienced people such as yourself and the staff to become familiar with these procedures, at least to some extent, because you also play an important role in the community in terms of being credible experts in emergency response. And I would be very interested to learn what you think of how well PG&E can undertake these actions where the staff would likely be, the operators would likely be working under stressful conditions that would be outside their normal range of experience, but for which people who serve as firefighters deal with on a more routine basis. So for all of those reasons, I think that this coordination that you're asking for is a wise thing to be pursued. And I would hope that there's some way to make sure that happens fairly expeditiously. And again, I'd really appreciate the opportunity for us to further engagement on this, because I think that the insights that you can bring are significant. And we also need to remember that in an event like you had at Fukushima, or a security-related event, we may not have all of the operating staff available because of the severity of some of the events that we consider. And so having the capacity to bring in outside resources may be very important.
And I think I want to reassure you and the community that Fortunately, California are leaders in the ability to mobilize rapidly to an emergency. It's common during some type of emergency, as an example, a wildfire, for us to be able to mobilize over 1,000 firefighters within 12 hours, have them briefed and prepared to go out into onto the fire lines. I know I can do that for any emergency. I have that behind me as a process that's well exercised. I'd like to make sure that that same we're also capable of doing that in support of not just Diablo Canyon, but frankly all the nuclear power plants in the United States. I need to know that we can mobilize not fire service, but we're as the industry is able to mobilize rapidly to get help from other plants or from fire departments or from whoever that they need it. There are systems that have been in place in this country to do that for all disasters. I want to make sure it's in place for specifically Diablo.
Yeah, I think, again, the idea of joint training exercises sounds tremendous because your staff have experience and skills that doubtless would be helpful to bring in. And so that sounds like a wonderful idea.
I just had one question. You mentioned that there was an MOU, and I wondered how old was the MOU and if we might review it in context of our looking at this issue with that. I assume it's probably a public document. And would it be with Cal Fire and PG&E?
Yes, it's. I couldn't tell you when the first MOU was developed. I want to say it was in the very early 80s when the plant was licensed.
Right.
Generally, it's annually updated. Okay. It has been in the last several years for annually updated. It's a simple document. It's only several pages long, and it spells out what responsibilities PG&E has and what responsibilities the county fire department has to on-site response. It does not involve off-site response for an incident that would spread to off-site.
Off-site.
That's part of county OES that is responsible for that.
Right.
This is fire department operations at the site
at
itself.
The plant. Yes.
I mean, and that's certainly available. PG&E or myself can certainly provide that to you.
That would be great. I think it would be good to just take a look at it in context.
Yes, indeed. The committee would like to thank you for your tremendous insights and thoughtful comments.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. Yes, indeed. I think it is time for us to take a short break to recalibrate our schedule. So any members of the public, would you please come to the podium? And please introduce yourself.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Lisa Bonnier. I am on an agriculture liaison advisory board for our supervisors. I am also a farmer within the area. I believe it is the 10-mile zone of Diablo. As you know, San Luis Obispo County has our main industry is agriculture, and just like Fukushima, Diablo is surrounded by agriculture. And so I would like to have an update what is happening to the agriculture in that area. How are they approaching soil contamination and food safety and the re-entrance of land, of productive land, getting it back into production. I also listened to how you talked about how to better deliver resources that are needed to the area. I experienced Chernobyl and the food contamination from that accident. And as you know, if the contamination was widespread, it would be from San Luis Obispo all the way to Texas. We had food issues, food safety issues. If there was an incident at Diablo, how would you deal with safety for food and for relocating food into a very large area potentially? Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Peterson, would you care to respond?
Yes, I can respond to that. I don't have detailed information on what has happened in Japan with respect to food safety and restrictions on food, but there have been
public health measures taken to restrict the distribution of foods that would have been farmed and also cattle and milk from areas nearby because of the contamination. With respect to the activities in the United States, a part of the emergency planning process includes the question of the longer-term monitoring of and control of agricultural activities following an accident. And emergency planning exercises periodically will exercise that part as well with, I can't remember which federal agency it is that participates in that aspect. But all of that needs to be reevaluated with respect to lessons from Japan and Fukushima, along with all of the other things, because clearly there's much to be learned from what has happened there. And that, I think, will be an element of the future emergency response training and other things. I think maybe PG&E might be able to say a couple of words on that as well, possibly.
Mr. Sharp?
No. No. Your quick question again?
Just with respect to the emergency response training and with respect to the off-site impact and control of food, agriculture.
We do have training that we do periodically on, like, ingestion zone training that mm-hmm. happens in the 50-mile circle to make sure that we not only can monitor, that we can also take appropriate recommendations that we provide to the county on what we do in those kinds of situations to make sure we're monitoring and as well as trending wherever any plume might have gone, as well as the recommendations that we would provide the county who really makes the determination on what they do for protective actions.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments from the public? Okay, let's move on to next item on our agenda, which will be a continuation of a presentation from PG&E. I now would turn the podium over to Mr. Lawrence Sharp. He's the Senior Director of Technical Services, one of the most senior managers at the Abel Canyon. Mr. Sharp.
Thank you. Our next speaker is from our electrical engineering manager. Ryan West is our INC and electrical system engineering manager from on-site, and he'll talk to us about electrical systems.
Mr. West, welcome to our proceeding.
Thank you. I'll give them an opportunity to get the slides together here. As Lauren said, my name is Ryan West, and I am the engineering manager for INC and Electrical Systems. We refer to it as ICE. What I'm going to be presenting here today is an overview of the Diablo Canyon electrical distribution system. That includes the capability to maintain power to the equipment required to in the interface between the 500 kV system and the generator. We have this relatively small system here that's at 25 kV, and it's basically used to transfer power between the generator and the grid, and also our house loads, which are fed via two auxiliary transformers here. The next level down is a 12 kV system, and it basically operates some large motors, essentially, which are the four reactor coolant pump motors, as well as two circulator water pumps. All of the described equipment here would be considered our non-vital or non-design class one equipment. At the 4 kV level or 4,000 volt level is where we would consider vital. There's three buses on each unit. They're bus F, G, and H, Foxtrot, Golf, and Hotel. Those are the three vital buses. And there's also two non-vital 4 kV buses that run equipment on the secondary side of the plant. So those are kind of displayed there. As you can see, those non-vital buses do not have emergency diesels. So, we'll get into more detail later. Below the four kV, each of these 4 kV buses also feed 480 volt load centers, which run small motors as well as motor operated valves, heaters and such, and then all the way down to 120 volt. And the 480 volt system also feeds battery chargers, which ultimately drive our DC system, which includes batteries as well as a 125 and 250 volt DC system. They're not shown here, but they'll come up on a later slide. Next slide, please. So just a quick overview. I mean, ultimately, our preferred source of power is either from our generator or from the transmission grid. So under normal operation, we'd be in this configuration here, where configuration 3, where our generator would be supplying power to both Diablo Canyon loads as well as to the grid. When we're offline, we have the ability to open this motor-operated disconnect and supply our Diablo Canyon loads via the 500 grid. And the configuration 2 here is a way to supply Diablo Canyon loads from the 230 kV grid. So these are just normal alignments for the grid to get power to the site. So just a quick discussion on design class 1 or safety-related electrical distribution system. And here, primarily talking about from the 4 kV vital buses, that's F, G, and H, down. The vital power is basically, it's credited with protecting the health and safety of the public. And that includes cooling the reactor, protecting fission product barriers, monitoring the status of the reactor. As you saw on the previous couple of slides, there are 3 independent vital power sources. And those are F, G, and H, as described there. And each of those has 3 sources of power. So as was described, you can from the 500 kV system, we have the 230 kV system, and each of those has a dedicated diesel generator, which is capable of operating all of the equipment connected to that bus. Each of these has a independent or 480 volt and 120 volt systems that are connected to each of those buses, and also a dedicated DC backup, and we'll go into that here a little bit in the next slide. And it's also important to note that these vital or design class 1 electrical systems, they are seismically qualified for design basis earthquakes. So next slide, it's a little busy, but it just kind of opportunity to kind of see the independence and as well as the interrelationship between the portions of the distribution system. So just taking a look at, let's say, the 1 hotel or 1H here kind of gives you an idea. So that's the 4 kV bus there. That 4 kV bus feeds the battery chargers, and which feeds the battery, charges the battery, also supplies power to the each unit. It's not directly credited for protecting the health and safety of the public. This is typically the equipment that's associated with generation or support functions at the station. Each of these buses, unlike the vital buses, only has 2 sources of power, which is basically from the grid, 500 kV, which includes the generator, as well as the 230 kV system. And similar to the vital, the 480, the 4 kV non-vital buses feed the lower buses. However, there's not the same independence that you see on the vital buses. There's the ability to cross tie and move things from one bus to the other. There is backup batteries for the non-vitals. And we'll show those on the next next slide. And while not seismically qualified for a design basis earthquake, the non-vital systems are qualified to uniform building code. So.
Which is much less robust and stringent than the seismic design basis event qualification.
That is correct.
System.
That is correct. So just to, again, I know it's a busy slide, but it kind of shows these are the four KV buses, Delta and Echo. And you can see all of the non-vital buses, and these are all at 480 volts that are fed from there. And you can see the ability to cross-tie and move things from one 4 KV feed to the other. And you can also see the, so we have two batteries, 15 and 16, that feed panels. And there's the ability, there is some interrelationship between them, but there is battery backup on the non-vital equipment. And another thing is, you can see that there are not UPSs on the system in general. There are individual loads that we might find to be important that we will have inverters on. For example, digital feed water, you'll see there it has an inverter associated with it. The plant process computer does. So, also, with that, that's the overview of the electrical distribution system. Do you have any questions?
No. Mr. West, for a hypothetical station blackout scenario in which you lose all off-site power or diesel generators, how long would the DC battery last, and how long was it designed for?
For a non-design basis loss of off-site power, the DC batteries on the vital buses would last in the order of 5 to 6 hours, and during that time, we would get one of the six diesels back. And if you go back to I think it's slide six. Keep going. Okay. One more. I'm sorry, one more seven. Okay. So the diesel generators are tied to each of the buses. So once AC power is available from a diesel generator, which can be started without any AC power, that would restore power to the battery chargers and recharge the batteries.
Sure, but absent that success, it would last between 5 and 6 hours?
That's correct.
Would you be able to extend the battery life by turning off some other non-essential users?
That's correct. The operators would have the capability of basically shedding load and extending the battery life. For a design basis accident with a loss of off-site power, the batteries are, so that's under maximum load, that time would go to 2 hours to get a diesel started.
Okay. Now, I was on site at the battery room for both unit one and two, and at the corner of the wall, adjacent to the ceiling, there was penetration. And I was informed there used to be a cross tie between unit one and unit two batteries. And the cross tie has been disabled for a reason that was not provided to me. The question is it a good idea to revisit that issue to see the cross tie is available?
Between the diesels?
No, between the batteries.
On the DC power system, the vital DC.
Okay, I'm not familiar with cross tie that existed. There was a cross tie the original plant design. There was the bus Foxtrot diesel was a shared component, so it was shared between both units. And that would have been the or the battery chargers for your DC equipment.
Sure. Dr. Peterson?
Related question. The post-Fukushima reviews, I believe, are going to involve some assessment of whether additional battery capacity needs to be added to plants.
That is my understanding.
And so I presume that will be an activity undertaken at Diablo Canyon. Alternative to that might be to have the capacity to hook up on-site portable generators to recharge batteries. And I'm not sure what the best balance is between those two things. But currently, does the capability to hook up portable generators exist and procedures to recharge batteries, or is that not available?
As far as the implant equipment, I'm not aware of procedures to recharge the implant batteries beyond the installed
using equipment. Portable generation equipment.
That's correct.
Okay.
That is being evaluated as part of the Fukushima response.
Do you have an idea what the schedule is for looking at these questions about either augmenting the existing battery capacity or improving or adding, sort of pre-installing capability to hook up portable generators?
I would expect at least the initial response on those issues within 150 days of receiving those. Industry event report that came out from Impulse, that we'd have 150 days to provide a response.
Good. I think actually that's a good thing for us to make sure is on our beyond design basis action list for fact-finding review, because at Fukushima, portable generators were brought in, and the first set that came in had the wrong voltage, if I recall, to be hooked up. The second set, the connection equipment didn't work. They had subsequently got some portable generators hooked up and were going to be restoring power into Unit 2 when the Unit 1 explosion occurred and severed the cables. And so essentially the attempts to install and use portable generation equipment to restore some of the vital functions were thwarted by lack of effective preparation to be able to do it, and that's one of the reasons why it's an important area that to review, in addition to the procedures and capabilities for hooking up portable pumping equipment to inject water.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah.
I had this question. The non-vital power systems are not designed to seismic category 1 like the safety systems, but they are designed to the Uniform Building Code seismic standards.
That's correct.
And my question is, I'm thinking that the San Simeon earthquake of 2002, is that the right date? Was that the strongest earthquake to hit the plant? My memory says yes. And the question is this. How did the non-vital power systems cope with that earthquake?
There were no issues with the non-vital power equipment. I believe San Simeon earthquake, the ground motion at the site was somewhere around 0.04 Gs. And the Uniform Building Code is on the order of a quarter G. So there was a significant amount of margin to the design requirements.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Bennis? No. Okay. Thank you, Mr. West, for your presentation. Mr. Sharp?
Thank you.
I'm Lauren Sharp, Senior Director of Technical Services. Going to get a presentation up here. So I have had opportunity to talk an awful lot about seismic lately. I suspect you'll see a number of slides in this area. I'll talk a little bit this morning about, go to the next slide, about our shoreline report status, about the ongoing seismic studies, a little bit of an update on the tsunami hazard study, as well as an update on the seismic induced systems interaction housekeeping program. So in the next slide, we talk a little bit about, we supplied the shoreline report to the NRC in January of 2011, which provided an update of all of our analysis with that recent analysis and report. The NRC is reviewing that at this point in time. They indicate that they've done the portions that they can. It's being shipped off to their subcontractor, and that will be then reviewed by them for a final report back to us in the January 2012 timeframe.
Now, Mr. Sharp, the reason they farm it out, is it because of lack of resources or lack of manpower or lack of expertise?
I think probably twofold. They're fairly active right now with the North Anna things, but I think in general some of the actual areas of expertise aren't resonant as much in NRC as they are with the Southwest Research Institute, and that's why they've energy 2D work If you look at the color of the slides here, we're doing roughly 122 miles of road onshore. Those that are in red are those where we started last week doing functional testing of our equipment and then working out on the Diablo lands for the most part. We advanced our schedule about a month, and we did that to try and ensure that we got as much activity on the dirt roads before it started getting too much in the rainy season. And then we'll progress off into more of the private roads and then subsequently onto the paved county roads and even Caltrans roads and some city roads. So we've done an awful lot of activity. We have most of the permits we're getting. We have to have encroachment permits or right of entry permits. We have most of the property owners that we ask have provided their approval. We have just recently received county approval for the city, for the county of San Luis Obispo. We're imminent on the city of San Luis Obispo and on Pismo Beach, and we've already received Morro Bay. We have the Caltrans pending yet, and we're having some trouble with one of our public agencies, and we're trying to work our way through that process to see if we can get that through before we run out of our window of time.
So permitting is not a trivial issue.
Pardon?
Permitting is not a trivial process. It takes some time. Right?
This one didn't trigger any use permits, but in order to even, we're doing all of our testing really on existing roadways, but just getting encroachment permits has proven challenging than we had anticipated in some cases.
I'm not surprised, but could you describe a little bit what it is like to be nearby if you've got one of these trucks doing the vibration? Is it like it'll bounce you off the ground, or you can feel it? I assume you can feel something.
I assumed you would ask a question like that, so why don't we run the video?
Oh, good.
This video was taken in the May time frame. We went down to watch an activity in Long Beach.
Okay.
There are really four of these. These are the vibrator trucks. They raise up. They're end-to-end. They wirelessly communicate and coordinate so that they in harmony, provide the signal to the Earth's crust. And that fellow with the pole right there is measuring the vibration at the street side adjacent to where the trucks are. They typically are less than a quarter of an inch per second. Well below any damage of any infrastructure, and you can barely feel it when you, I would say, when you're standing near the curb, you feel it just a little bit in your legs, but it dissipates fairly quickly. I would liken it more to like a garbage truck. When a garbage truck comes by, these stay in place about 5 minutes, usually typically 3 to 5 minutes. They provide the signal, then they pick up and move to the next spot, do it again, and even in some cases, you'll see when we drive by, most of the people that were sitting on benches didn't even know we were going by. So it was kind of an interesting. This guy didn't even know we went by. So give you a sense that. So in general, I thought I'd give you at least a little bit of a synopsis. They are ongoing right now. They are out in moving from Diablo property up into the private properties today. And we'll start going on to county roads here probably before the end of the weekend. Mm. We did take along a water with a colored liquid in it to show, even next to the vibrator trucks, we didn't see any substantial. There's a little bit of wiggle, and that's about all you note in the liquid. So it's fairly low signal and vibration. So a little bit of a show and tell anyway. Thanks, Pete. So we're doing this like on 122 miles of road, and go one more slide. Okay, so we're using a vibrator trucks and remote receivers. I'll show you pictures of the trucks in more detail as well as the receivers, and we actually have started collecting data. That started last week. This is what the truck looks like. There are four of these. There are 64,000. They are used on wide to moderate roads. There are areas where we can't go based on size or slope. So if you go to the next slide, we use what they call accelerated weight drop. They also nicknamed this the thumper. It has the advantage that it can go a lot of places. The disadvantage is it doesn't penetrate as deep. So the vibrator trucks, we're trying to get down in the range of the 10 to 12 kilometers, which is the thickness of the Earth's crust around this part of the country, as a, particularly where the water comes into the coastline. This particular vehicle will only go about half of that distance. So it's more in a 5 kilometer, 6 kilometer range. Next slide. This is kind of what the it looks like in the flags is what we call nodes. We have wireless nodes, and I'll show you a picture of that in a minute. We're going to use roughly 5,000 nodes.
There's people on our tour, so we got to see the little yellow boxes.
It definitely is. You can see them pretty much where they've been because they've been putting the flagging out there, and then we go along and install them in general. So that gives you a sense of the 2D high-energy onshore work. So that work is ongoing. Now I'm going to start talking about the 3D high-energy offshore work. This one is a permitted activity, which is will trigger an environmental impact or study and report that has to be created, so we're going through that process. This shows the what we call the racetrack. We have looked at the size of areas. So the northern area is roughly 547 miles. The southern area is 765 miles. So that time frame shown doesn't incorporate any downtime for maintenance or weather or any time when we would have to shut down due to if a whale came within the inner noise circle, we would have to shut down. So all those downtimes would not be in that time calculation. So we expect that the window of time to do this would be from September to December of next fall. It will be an expedited process. We're working very hard with all the agencies to get the permits, and right now that's where we're headed. If you go to the next slide. We have gone out and done a procurement for a number of vendors. We have identified, this is the Langseth. This is a boat out of Columbia University. The boats that do this type of work are specially outfitted, and essentially they have streams of hydrophone streamers behind and air guns behind. This technology replaces the technology where you used to use explosives, so much more advanced than the earlier days. If you go to the next slide, this gives you an indication. There are essentially, in the configuration we're headed towards, there will be four streamers behind the ship with receivers that are roughly 3.7 miles long. There will be two air gun streamers in the middle right behind the boat, nine air guns in each streamer that will be used with a spare in each line. The actual receivers will be towed at roughly 33 feet below the water surface. The air guns will be towed at roughly 30 feet below the surface. The air guns will go off about every 16 seconds or every 123 feet, and they'll create an air bubble that will essentially will collapse. And so if you go to the next slide, you can see a little bit of the characteristics about the air guns, the capabilities of models, and what we're doing for using that type of technique to get our indications. Next slide. This shows how it will actually work for the same type of a model as what you saw on the land, is essentially the signals are detected and bounced back up to the streamers that are behind it. Due to the draft of the boats, we can't obviously take these larger ships in near the coastline, and so to handle those faults that are in the surf zone area, we've come up with a different technique. And we have put out a strategy of using five lines that are going to go out past the three-mile limit, and they will employ these geophones that are going to then be attached to a line on shore. They'll be deployed out, spaced all the way out past three-mile island, a three-mile limit, so we can get the signal. And we'll actually be doing signals from a onshore 2D as well as the ships in the water to provide signals to the surf zone area when if we get the permit as so far proposed. This would show you how we would deploy the nodals that go on the ocean bottom floor as well as the survey vessel that would be going along in the water in the vicinity of these geophones. This depicts really three things for the offshore permitting piece. We have the lower portion where we would actually be using the onshore seismic vehicles for sources on the access roads near Diablo Canyon. The other blocks show, like on the Morro Bay strands, we would have the receivers there, and up by Cambria we would have receivers up there as well. As you remember, the racetrack, it had a fairly long length, and we would be doing essentially the racetrack in offshore of all these vicinities would still give us some signals in the onshore portions. So this figure shows, that's the end of the 3D high energy. This figure shows the 2D, 3D low energy offshore portions. We have done a portion of the northern green area for the offshore work that was done in the October to February time frame this year. We're getting ready to start in the November time frame in the southern portion to look more for a piercing point. There's an old river channel there. We're trying to determine basically slip rate of any fault in that area. And then we'll go back once we're done with the southern area, and we will continue finishing up the rest of the green area in the northern that we have not completed yet. So we would finish doing both these green zones as part of our low-energy offshore work for seismic. On the right is an indication of the permanent ocean bottom seismometers with a low-profile concrete raised roughly a ton over top of the sensor that embeds it into the soft ocean bottom floor. It will then be deployed, and we'll listen and as it connects to the wired line that we drag along the bottom of the ocean bottom floor to install this. That will be done by a ship on top. The ones on the left are the temporary ones. You'll notice in the foreground the dark cylinder on the bottom is a concrete cylinder. What happens when we're ready to remove those from the water? We go along and electronically discharge the cylinders. The buoyancy of the rack causes it to rise, and the cylinders are still attached by a cable to the frame, and then we can retrieve the cylinders as well. So that's how the temporary units will be. We'll have two of these. We'll employ them in two locations, run them for about 2 weeks, and then we'll go and put them in the other two locations. So these are the types of permits that we have been engaging on. We started, obviously, in the April time frame on a number of these. The State Lands Agency is a lead agency for the high-energy 3D offshore work. We also have provided a number of permits for the Cal Fish and Game Marine Protected Area, the minimum negative mitigated negative deck process for OBS is in the process, and we're trying to respond to questions and comments that we're getting from the agencies. And again, as I stated, the onshore 2D did not trigger any use permit, but we had a lot of encroachment permits we've had to do. Next slide. These are the variety of agencies that I'm dealing with on almost a daily basis as we're trying to get through all of the comments and questions that are coming up associated mostly with the 3D high energy offshore, although a number of those on the right side are with the access and encroachment permits we're trying to get for the 2D onshore that we're ongoing with right now. This is from anticipated agencies. We anticipate that to get through the process to get to the 3D high energy offshore work, we'll need to work our way through all of these. We anticipate in order for us to make the time frame next fall, number one, when we're out of the whale migration time frame and we have a window of time that we think is the most beneficial for least impact, that's in the fall time frame. So we're pushing pretty hard to try and get the permits so that we can start before that September time frame. And obviously that's causing some challenges for all the agencies, but we're working with them as best we can to try and make that happen. Basically a year from now. And this is just essentially this is the current schedule that we have. We are required to provide an update to the ASLB, the Atomic Licensing Safety Board, on where we are in our current estimate of schedule. This is the last schedule that we provided, and we'll be doing an update here next week, and we're starting to relook at the dates to see if we need to adjust any right now. For a tsunami hazard, we did our tsunami design basis is in the FSAR. I would mention that it's a deterministic licensing basis, and we went after the deterministic licensing basis is based on really distance-generated tsunami and locally generated nearshore tsunamis, and it's combined with a water level for high tide, storm surge. That's how we really got our deterministic licensing basis. We did a study on the probabilistic tsunami hazard analysis just to make sure we understood what the differences may or may not be. We did that study. It basically looked at all the probabilistic methods and essentially confirmed the adequacy of the existing deterministic licensing basis. But we certainly have some other actions we'd like to go and do a little bit more in this area. If you go to the next slide. We tried to get a meeting set up last week with the Peer Center and the other agencies to do a meeting on tsunami, and we couldn't get on anybody's calendar really last year before Fukushima happened. We suspect we'll find more interest this year as we try and get some kind of an audience for a workshop on tsunami this year. So we suspect this will likely happen in the near term, and we really are looking to basically look at some of the modeling uniqueness features of the numerical models to make sure that we have a consensus with the industry experts in these areas to make sure that we're handling the algorithms as the models as appropriate, because it's certainly a new assessment tool in this type of an area. It's not something that is currently, it's not part of the NRC process. There's a deterministic licensing basis, but we suspect it will have something that generates interest as we move forward in the future.
Yeah, just for the public, the Peer Centers, the Peer stands for the Pacific Earthquake Engineering.
When they're in specific areas, what the rules are and how they need to anchor or tie off that equipment. It also provides the objective on why we have this program to start with, and it provides guidance to the people on site on how they need to go out when they do inspections to make sure that they review and assure and confirm that the equipment is adequately supported and secured. Next slide. So we have a performance monitoring. We do monthly inspections on all these plant areas except containment. We do, when we exit refueling outages, we secure and make sure we clean up everything in containment so it is secure. And then since we don't do really work in containment online, we just inspect the rest of the areas outside containment while we're at power. And we have a program owner that does monthly assessments, and we do random health reports to make sure we're doing well on our process. It does have a periodic quick hit, and we just recently added a formal self-assessment process to make sure we continually look at this to make sure it meets our expectations.
What is the health of the program now?
Right now, it's good. You know, we have green. It's green.
Green. Okay.
We have, as you might imagine, as we've looked at other sites. There are some other sites that have a similar program, but most don't. So, you know, obviously due to our nature, this is a program we have employed here, and we maintain it as a major focus at Diablo Canyon. It's really associated with part of our operating license and our programs to be a little bit more formal than most other programs have been that we've been out and witnessed. Like I said before, we currently show it as a positive status in the most recent health report. We have had some adverse trends in the recent that we dealt with a self-assessment and apparent cause, make sure that we went back and identified a program owner. We did a single point of contact for that owner. We did additional walk-down focus by the plant leadership and management. So we've gone back and refreshed our procedures and put this criteria actually in our handbooks for workforces that come on, not only during the normal time but during outages, to make sure they understand our expectations. So we've enhanced this area quite a bit, and it seems to have been going in the right direction as we've done our recent reviews and assessments.
Do you recall after the San Simeon earthquake whether the inspections after the earthquake showed any SISA problems?
Before my time, so I can't answer that.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Comments, Dr. Peterson?
Dr. Brandes?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Shah. This is a tremendous presentation. It's very informative. Not only that, you now bring us back on schedule. Thank you. This is time for public comments. Any member of the public, please come to the podium and introduce yourself.
I have just one question coming from slide 26 concerning about the continental shelf. If you want to find out about the landslides on the continental shelf, don't you need to go beyond the 3-mile limit to get the whole shelf, because sometimes there are vestiges of landslides that are beyond the continental shelf. That's my question.
For our records, let the record reflect that the speaker is Ms. Lewis.
Yeah, Sherry
from
Lewis.
The Mothers,
yeah.
From the Mothers for Peace. Dr. Bernice, Dr. Peterson?
I'm not an expert.
Right. With Mr. Sharp, would you care to respond to Ms. Lewis' inquiry?
Yeah, I'd like to say that, again, remember the studies that we're doing right now are 3D seismic studies to basically do mapping and assessment of how deep in the Earth's crust and the angle of these earthquake faults are. These studies that we're doing right now are not for any landslide in subterranean areas.
Well, what did it say on page 26 then? It was about continental shelf and landslide areas.
Well, what I did is I provided an update of the ongoing seismic studies that we're going on right now. But the slide on 26 was just to provide an update that we had done a tsunami study, and we had some questions on the algorithms and the methodologies that we wanted to make sure we were reviewed by the industry experts. And that's one of the areas basically that they're looking at is essentially, is there any other research or knowledge that needs to be gained in those areas? And that's an area that the experts have not really provided a consensus on at this point.
Because I had heard that bathymetry of beam, so it wouldn't be the 3D study.
It's not, but none of these studies. No.
Bathymetry would show what's going on beyond the right past the shelf.
Well, we've done bathymetry like in a previous study near the areas of the Diablo Canyon to provide more of a look at the types of earthquake fault lines and areas near Diablo Canyon. There are many questions that are of interest to the scientific
community. They may decide that the instrument is sensitive enough, or that the information they gather can be extracted from various background noise and the like, so that there may be value in doing more, but they're not going to decide that until after they've done this first thing, which happens to be a piggyback. So only later, and also based on the tsunami expertise of some other people, will there be a possible extension of the tsunami work further, depending on whether they decide that they can actually extract anything from it.
Thank you.
So this is a work in progress, and it's unabashedly a work in progress.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Any member of the public would wish to address the committee at this time? Absent any public comments at this time, the morning session is adjourned. We will reconvene exactly at 12:45 p.m. Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to our afternoon session of the 64th public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. Dr. Peterson, any comments you'd like to make at this time?
No.
Okay. Dr. Butness is coming to the podium. Dr. Butness, any comments you'd like to make this time? Okay, without any comments from Dr. Butness and Dr. Peterson, let's go to the next item on the agenda, would be a session for public comments and communication to the committee. Any member of the public who wish to address the committee on items not in our agenda, please do so at this time. And hearing none, let me go to next item on the agenda, which will be information that the committee had requested from PG&E. Mr. Bellison, do we have a representative from PG&E?
Second.
Do we have anybody from PG&E who's available?
We have the next speaker here.
That's what we asked. Okay, should we wait for Mr. Becker or should we proceed? Okay, so please approach the podium and
introduce yourself.
Good.
Hi, Dan.
I guess are we using mics?
I am Dan Brosnan.
And Dan, I hope you know that this is being streamed on SlowSpan, so there are people out there who are watching besides what's in the room.
I understand. It is my privilege to be here with you this afternoon and talk about a subject that's very dear and near to my heart. Today we are going to talk about a subject very involved in nuclear safety. And this subject has a very significant investment and has been a very profound impact on protecting the health and safety of the public here for Diablo Canyon. So I'm very pleased to be here with you and share that information with you, and I hope when we're done today you share some of that importance with me. Quick background, I've been with Pacific Gas and Electric about since 89 on the project, both here in Diablo Canyon and in San Francisco. I hold a bachelor's and master's in electrical engineering. I have a state of California registration in electrical and in nuclear engineering. Been at this for a while. Where are we? The subject, containment sumps. And you asked for some a broad background discussion of what we have been doing with our containment sumps. And these were the topics that you asked me to address today. So the subject of containment sumps, it's we're here to discuss, is the potential for debris blockage. Now remember, this all starts with a loss of coolant accident. Nothing happens. We don't need this piece of equipment. We never intend to use this piece of equipment. So until we have a loss of coolant accident, and until we have an injection phase and fills with water, we don't need a sump to recirculate it. So that's what we're talking about today. So the subjects that you've asked for, a timeline, a path to resolution, you asked to discuss some of the outside cooling suction strainers in their dry well that they do use under normal shutdown. And there were two instances, one at Perry Nuclear Plant in 1993, where the strainers became clogged with debris in a normal shutdown. And another instance in 95 at Limerick, when there was a thin mat of fiber and sludge that was collected on their strainer, and both caused problems. So that started the boilers to look at this whole issue in detail. They went from a typical strainer size of less than 100 square feet to an average of about 2,000.
A quick question. Sure. In the boiler water reactors, where are the strainers located? Is it wet well or where are the in the boiling water reactor?
They're in the dry well.
They're in the dry well.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And what's the normal use?
It's like they're refueling water storage. It's like they're refueling water storage tank. They use the dry well during refueling, so they do it every time.
Okay. Okay.
They use that pathway for refueling.
Okay.
So, as a result of that and the work with the boilers, and
they flood the whole dry well?
The dry well
around
typically
the reactor. No.
The reactor dry well is typically full of water.
No, but you've got pumps and equipment down there, so there must be some water down.
Yes.
Someplace, and then so this is a strainer that's above the water dam that's in the refueling.
No. Let me not get into the details of the boilers.
Okay.
I'm not
it's
by anywhere.
Here, it's downstream of them.
I understand.
At any rate, they
many
have,
of these yeah. boiler, these okay. strainers at the boilers were actually installed underwater. They did them in order not to shut down the plant or drain the dry well. They actually installed them underwater.
I had not been familiar with how the sump strainer issue had been originally discovered. It's very interesting to know. Thanks.
Sure. Sure. Me too.
It's downstream of those.
I'll
talk about it later.
If I may ask,
anyway.
The generic letter was issued about 7 years ago. So in your comments, would you please highlight some of the areas that for the benefit of the member of the public, how come things took so long to resolve?
Sure, be happy to do that.
I have a timeline, and we'll go through it later.
Yes, indeed.
So then we moved on to the, after they pretty much completed the work on the boilers, they started to look at pressurized water reactors, and that's when the generic issue, safety issue, was written in the generic letter. The function of the strainer. Remember, during the event, you will have a pipe break, and water leaks into containment. And then after an injection period of water, then the containment sumps come into action as a reservoir for water to recirculate back into the core. So that's really the function. It serves as a water source to support long-term recirculation and core cooling. That's the primary reason it exists. And so it then includes the water source, the pump inlets, the piping, and other safety components that are part of this whole design. Here's just a typical picture inside containment, the left being, you see the reactor vessel in the middle there, the orange vessel, the going outward, the reactor coolant pumps that circulate the fluid, and then the steam generators they don't boil it. They do boil steam on the secondary side, and it goes outside to run the turbines. Now, you see, if you break any one of those pipes, what happens in the second slide is that the water will and steam will go into containment, but will be contained by containment. And you'll see the various pathways that are all analyzed when we do this work. And that little red dot on the right corner is the containment sump screen, where the water will collect. That's what that picture is all about. Prior to, or as soon as this happens, within a minute, we will be injecting water into the core. And then that water comes from the refueling water storage tank, and we empty that 455,000-gallon tank right here, if necessary. I mean, depending on the size of the leak, but. And then that water and all the water that's in the system already collects on the floor. Okay. Here is a fairly detailed.
Do you also have transients for main steam line break, where you would activate like containment spray and then have to go to recirc? Are there any main steam line break or secondary breaks that also?
We do analyze main steam line breaks, but they're not a loss of coolant accident in the core. So it's
no, right, I understand.
No,
so
none
they don't
of those consequences. Right. We just isolate the main steam and you're done.
So you,
there were very different criteria. We had an 80 square foot strainer. Diablo took, I think, very significant initiative. In 2000, before any of this became an industry issue, we increased that number to 700 square feet on our own. And we thought, when this all started in 2004 and beyond, that we were in very good shape. And actually, we were. But we went down that process and tested our strainer with our debris load and started testing our insulation to see how it mattered. But in 2006, chemical effects were introduced. And when chemical effects were introduced, we issued a purchase spec for a new strainer. That new strainer that you just saw in the previous picture is 3,300 square feet. The balance is you don't want to make too big, because then you can let a lot of fiber bypass the screen onto the fuel. So you really want it to be a filter. You don't want it too small, because then you need enough suction head for the pumps. So it's a very delicate balance to make sure you're filtering the debris so that the debris does not go to the core, but you have enough flow to the pumps to cool the core. And that's why we do all the testing that was going on. You see steam jet testing. You see strainer head loss testing. Bypass testing, fiber bypass testing, was done at that time.
Now, your pumps are reasonably robust, so they can take some debris at the propellers.
I'm sorry?
The pumps are pretty robust, so if there are some debris that pass through the screen, it would not harm the pump.
That's correct. That's called bypass and ingestion. We did all those analyses for every pump, valve and heat exchanger that would see the debris laden through it. So that, yes, that is a very significant concern. Actually, one of the other things is particularly of issue is pump seals, to make sure that those pump seals, if there isn't wear on the pump seals with any of this kind of debris.
Is there debris? Okay, go on.
Then we topped this off with fuel head loss testing. So we actually did, after we got done with bypass testing, we know how much fiber then made it to the core, and we tested the core to make sure that we had ample flow and could cool the core and not have excess head loss on the fuel. In 2008, we wrote to the commission and told them we were done. The commission, to answer your question on timeline, when they issued generic letter 2004, they set a deadline for the industry of December 2007. And we did everything we could to meet that deadline. And we did do all the major improvements. What we did find out is that we had a major source of debris, insulation, on our steam generators. And in the following year, in 2009, we were going to replace our steam generators with new, and we could put new insulation on them that would not be a debris for the sump. So we did have that caveat, and the commission did allow us that caveat to be complete as soon as those steam generators were replaced. So that's why it took us a little bit longer. But then subsequently, December of 2009, Wiley and Westinghouse discovered an error in their jet testing. And we use jet testing to try to show that the debris on a pipe will stay on the pipe. If it's hit with a steam jet from a pipe break, the calcium silica or the fiber temp mat will stay there, not be ripped off and transported to the sump strainer as debris. So that was a very important part of our debris reduction methodologies in applying to reduce the debris for our sump. In the last year, the Pressurized Water Reactor Owners Group has been responding to NRC questions on jet blast effects and on the comparison of a jet to damage to insulation and how to make those comparisons. We finally got through that earlier this year and started retesting. And I'll show you some pictures of what we've been doing this year in that forum. And then finally, they've also been doing in-vessel fuel testing for long-term core cooling. We did that on our core back in 2008, and we're very comfortable with our solutions, but this was an industry-wide effort that we are also participating in. All right, so here's a big picture outlined to our path for resolution. Debris reduction, a larger strainer, and then testing for compliance. And that's what we did. And then the final step in the program is ongoing containment cleanliness, that we make sure that we clean it up after every outage so that this debris does not reach our sump. So just last month, I was in Huntsville, Alabama, and we were redoing the testing that we did in 06. What happened, it's a little hard to tell, but there's a steam jet nozzle that's on the left side. You see the first picture there on the left by itself. That's a 4-inch steam nozzle. It puts out 2,000 pounds of steam at 530 degrees Fahrenheit for about 10 seconds.
Wow.
It is like an explosion. It is like a violent explosion. When they set it off, it literally rains 100 feet away. It rains. There's so much water in the area. It will rain down on your head. It's a phenomenal thing to see. And what's important is that's our temp mat in the middle shot, as it is in the plant, and that's after blasting it with that steam jet. It stood up very well. It stayed there, it captured the debris, and we can prove by testing that we have a solid system to protect our plant. Very impressive. And here's just another example of our typical temp mat is a fibrous blanket like you'd use in your roof, in your house insulation. It's the same kind. It's much more dense, but it's similar fibrous material. Standard practice is to wrap that in stainless steel wire mesh, and that's what you see on the valve there in the left picture. We went around the plant and, in all those cases, jacketed it with another jacket to make sure that it would stay there for during an accident. This is another one at the test stand. This is a calcium silicon silicate insulated pipe. It's a 12-inch pipe. What we learned is that the original test actually damaged one of the layers of jacketing, and so we added a second layer. And this is the test with that second layer. And you can see we actually direct the jet right at the seam in the horizontal and a vertical seam of the jacket. And yes, it did lift it off. You can see in the right-hand picture that that external seam is ripped off. But it shows that the ultimate goal of retaining the insulation on the pipe is good. And so we were very pleased with that. And it was a struggle. I mean, we've been at this we did it originally in 06 and thought we were done then. So now we really are done. Here's another example. We have power cables underneath the pressurizer that energize the pressurizer heaters. That's a very hot room, and that insulation is very high temperature. It's made of fiberglass and mica, two components that are nasty things for some strainers. So we designed a cable cover tray system that will protect the insulation from a steam jet. The surge line is literally about 3 feet away from these. The 14-inch steam line is literally 3 feet away from these cable tray covers. And we showed in the right-hand picture that by double jacketing the cover, we have a successful insulation retention system by test. I mentioned to you before that one of our pre-screen impediments to debris is a debris interceptor. Well, there's three doors in the crane wall that looked like the left-hand picture, and we put a two-foot-high strainer screen in each door. And what was interesting, when we filled the entire screen with debris, we found that debris would whip over the top and keep right on going. We'd fill up a little cavity behind it, but the rest would start whipping over. By putting that additional ledge, we actually retained whatever was at that level behind the strainer. Very interesting phenomenon. Made that interceptor significantly more effective. So again, we learned a lot by test. Details of the strainer. Again, it opens it up for you, so you can kind of see. We have there's the actual horizontal plates, strainer assemblies, screen assemblies on the left side coming into the header there, and then again the vertical screen assembly sections of every outage to walk down the entire containment. We actually take swabs of white cotton. And then every couple of outages, we measure them. And because we have a latent debris number that we allow for in our strainer debris loading, and we test and make sure that we're meeting that. And we've done very well. In fact, the lowest numbers we had were after the steam generator replacement, where we went and really cleaned containment. So we know we can do it if we're serious about it. The last one was 95, so we're going to have to be a little bit more careful as we proceed. Lessons learned. You asked specifically about industry programs, and there are two major ones going on, and we are participating in both of them. One is the jet testing that you saw some pictures of, and the other is the fuel testing to confirm long-term core cooling. It's really the in-vessel effects of both deposition, debris deposition on the fuel and make sure there's sufficient temperature flow to cool the core as the criteria. One thing that we did at Diablo Canyon and tested at Diablo Canyon, both in our strainer and in our simulator, was the capability to backflush. That if, in fact, after all was said and done, the strainer would get clogged with debris so that you could no longer suck water through it. We have the capability, while cooling the core at the same time, to backflush the strainer and backflush the debris off of it. And that's a very rare capability in the industry. Very few plants, in fact, none that I know of, actually have this capability fully implemented.
Yeah, I'm glad you added that last sentence. It was my impression that there isn't any other plant out there that has this full capability.
Prairie Island was looking at it.
But
Looking at it. But we have proceduralized it and we have tested it.
Yes, and I understood that this was very old. This has been here. Two decades, right?
Yes, except we had to prove it with a new strainer.
Because it's new. But it had been there with the old strainer.
The concept was
of backflushing, correct?
Yes, that's true.
I had been told that came from the original PG&E engineering design.
It did. It was easier with the old atmospheric screen. All you had to do is shut the water off, and it would just fall off. This one, we really have to backflush.
I understand.
So it's you're pumping it water backwards.
Now, Mr. Bronson, backflashing is not a one-time mitigation, because once you backflash, the debris come off from the screen, and then you start your research again, so they will come back and clogging the screen again. So I would assume you would do that repeatedly when needed.
Interestingly, no. Our test showed once you did it, and it fell on the floor, and you reduced the flow, it doesn't return.
Oh, if you reduce the flow.
Remember the sequence. We start out at like 8,000 GPM of water when we're pumping water in the initial, and we're down to just minimal hundreds of GPM to keep the core cool after 30 days. I mean, it's... You're way down in flow, way down in linear feet into the strainer.
Right. So your need had diminished. So you don't need the high flow anymore.
Once you blow the debris off, it stays off. There is one other piece that is good that you mentioned. When you do that, you do introduce a little bit more bypass. Remember, now you've cleaned the screen, so you have to be careful. When we've looked at that bypass doesn't get out of hand.
That's a good point, right? Once you backflush, you don't need high flow anymore at that time, so they do not reaccumulate.
But we learned this by test. We weren't sure. We had the same concern you did. We thought we'd have to keep doing it or do it two or three times. We had the capability. We still can do that, but it's not necessary.
Right. Thank you.
The backflush. And the backflush, according to this, comes from the RWSD. That's what it says.
There's actually four different pathways.
I guess these four that are shown here, huh?
There are, yes.
Thank you. Yeah.
And there is a gravity feed. There is a backflush from the RHR sucking from the residual heat removal pump, or residual heat, fueling water tank. Remember, to do this, first of all, you'd probably have to refill that tank. I mean, so you're not doing this right away.
But you're doing this a long time after the accident.
Yes. We don't anticipate this. Well, first of all, we don't anticipate needing it at all. But what happens is if we get into operability situations, which we has committed to develop a path forward by mid-2012, and they said the same thing to their staff. So the commission has asked the staff to brief them every 6 months. There was just a meeting 2 weeks ago. And there'll be another report in December, and then the final report of June next in 2012, which will be the NRC's closure path. And we would anticipate, as Diablo Canyon, to be right in there with them. And I'll show you that in a minute. But I thought this last paragraph of their letter from 12/23 was very interesting, that given the vastly enlarged advanced strainers installed, the compensatory measures already taken, and the low probability of challenging pipe breaks, adequate defense in depth is currently being maintained. We have spent over $30 million to date on this effort, and we're going to spend a lot more before we're done. So, big picture summary. We talked about all of these things, but just to pick them off one at a time, we did have to install a new sump strainer assembly. It was 5 times the area of our 2000 and 40 times the area of the original screens. We modified the reactor cavity door. I didn't show you that, but we actually allowed water to go into the cavity and make sure we filled it up. You saw pictures of the three debris interceptors we put around the containment wall to capture debris before it even made to the screen. And we installed that multi-banding on approximately 1,400 linear feet of calcium-insulated piping. And we insulated some 58 targets of temp mat piping around various pipes and other insulations. We installed those tray covers to protect the pressure raiser heater cables, and we are going to go back and improve on that. We installed stainless steel jacketing over temp mat on the pressurized safety valves, and that was got rid of all of that fiber up top there. And then we removed calcium silicate, mineral wool, and installed stainless steel jacketed temp mat and insulation of reflective metal on all 4 steam generators, which was a major effort. So our remaining actions. We're going to do exactly what the commission has asked us to do, and that is we will finalize testing and this year, and we'll hopefully receive an NRC safety evaluation on that testing. We will update our supplemental response, which is our submittal to the commission on this subject, and after they concur and say, yes, this is it, then we will implement the necessary changes, which should be just adding the jacket to the calcil and adding the seam, the other cover, to the cable trace. That's all we know of at this point. But we'll do it in a forward direction rather than backwards, rather than doing the work first and submitting it for approval.
Sure.
I've got one quick question.
Sure.
Compared to the other PWR sites around the country, are you ahead of the schedule of most of the other ones, one of the leading ones in terms of schedule, or about with the rest of the pack, or what?
In my opinion, we're way ahead. We've tested our debris. We've tested our strainer. We've tested our bypass. We've tested our fuel. Many utilities in the United States haven't done that yet. They don't know. We started with fuel.
Thank you.
We didn't end with fuel. Sure. Most of the utilities in the United States started with a strainer. And when they got it too big, they found out they had too much bypass and clogged the fuel. Wrong equation. So I think we are definitely ahead of the industry from the way we approached the problem, because we understood that bypass was a very serious part of the design. Core cooling. But in fairness, we have been learning from our brethren too. I mean, we have been with them all the way through the trenches. This has been a learn by doing. The commission did not have the answers. They were telling us to go find the answers.
Another question. In the regulatory regime, does any regulatory position enable you to take credit for that backflushing? As opposed to safety space, it's great because if you need it, it'll be there. That's a different point.
I want to definitely credit it on the docket with the commission. When we credit a safety procedure, we carry with it a whole bunch of overhead reaction, training and maintaining, and we don't ever intend to use this. flushing doesn't meet all of those criteria.
Yeah, but on the other hand,
but it works.
Demanding it is not necessarily. It's such a remote eventuality.
Right. And we've tested it. We've taken it through the simulator. We know we can do it.
And in fact, other plants that don't have it will be judged adequately safe whether or not they've got it. I'm not arguing that case, but I bet that that's how the NRC will judge it.
I think they've asked us to credit it because they think it's an excellent capability that we have.
Great.
Yes.
Great.
Question. The large breaks today, we have some understanding that as long as one is monitoring for leakage and detects leakage, any leakage above the tech spec threshold of 1 GPM, that cracks cannot grow large enough to sustain a large break. Therefore, the risk from LOCA would be small break. Do small break scenarios get you into trouble with the debris and recirc flow needs the same way large breaks do, given large breaks may be very unlikely to occur?
General answer is no. If you think about it, many small breaks could be handled with just charging pumps, injection.
Yeah.
I'd never go to recirculation. I never even need the strainer.
Yeah.
So we could keep refilling the refueling water storage tank, injecting and cooling the core, and shutting down. I mean, we're not staying at power if we have a leak in containment. So it's all timing.
Yeah, actually, once you cool down, you might even be in a position to use RHR and no need for anything else.
I mean, there are many small break scenarios that we do not go on recirculation, period.
So it's just
an injection phase.
I think it's also important to emphasize that there is some conservatism here with respect to the sump strainer problem, because the type of initiating event, large break, today is believed to be highly unlikely if one is properly monitoring for leakage in the primary loop.
We agree, and the industry as a whole has been pressing the NRC to expand its use of GD's General Design Criteria 4 on leak before break, because this gives you a tremendous advantage in dealing with scenarios like this. We do not expect a large guillotine break of one of these kinds of pipes. And at worst, we'd see it crack and leak, and we could easily shut down before it would get any worse. The Commission has not yet accepted that for the entire response for the generic letter. Not yet, anyway. We keep bringing it up.
If I may add, I think your presentation had clearly provided a good example of how much effort and resources PG&E has devoted into resolving a generic issue identified by the Commission. Even though Dr. Peterson's sentiments well shared by most of us, that perhaps the large break event is not as likely as we believed many, many years ago. That said, I think still with the back flush capability and with all the work that you have done, I think the safety margin of the plan has been increased.
I agree, it has. And we've strived very hard to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. Any comments from Dr. Butness and Dr. Peterson? If none, well, Mr. Bronson, thank you for your presentation.
Pleasure. Happy to be here.
Nice work. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we now would entertain public comments at this time on what has been presented to the committee.
Hearing none?
No, there will be one. Yeah, I'm waiting for Mr. Bronson to get up the podium. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Sherry Lewis. I have just a couple of vocabulary questions. What does closing refer to? And bypass, you mentioned bypass, and I forgot what it meant.
Dr. Bennis?
Anybody?
Closing, Dr. Peterson?
Closing what? Closing an issue or closing a valve? I'm not sure.
Oh, probably issue. Closing the issue?
Resolving.
Oh, resolving. Okay.
Right. If it's an issue, it's resolving.
Yeah. When there's finality, we call it closure. When there is finality.
Right. It didn't say closure. Uh-huh. It was closing.
Many days after the accident at issue that we are contemplating, and hence it's not something that you're suddenly going to find yourself having to do. And hence, there is a lot of time even then to train and go over and assure that what you're about to do is well understood by all and that there aren't any conditions that might be adverse. And so, unlike some actions where there's just a very short time, and you really want to have training and training and training up front, here, there's lots of time later in the very remote eventuality, head to back flush, to train then again, even though it's already in the procedures and it's been trained and so on. That's what I meant by saying, well, heck, it's not something you got to do in 2 hours. These are many days thereafter. And I believe, and I assume Dan will confirm that, none of us can think of a scenario in which this comes about more rapidly. There don't seem to be. It's just not something that happens rapidly. These remote accidents evolve. This issue evolves very, very slowly.
Well, the issue evolves very, very slowly. But you should also know that our testing, our strainer head loss testing, was taken for a demission time of 30 days. We did enough through loop tests to take this out for 30 days. So we know at the end of 30 days we've got clean screen area. And we're not going. It's not going to get any worse. So we've tested that to have confidence that for 30 days we're okay, and beyond for that matter.
Thereafter. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bronson, and again, thank you, Ms. Lewis. Any comments from members of the public? Please do so at this time, as there is no more comments from the public at this time. I think we are still waiting for the next speaker from PG&E.
I understand our next speaker is en route, so I propose we break until he arrives.
Right. Perhaps we go to the last item on our agenda.
Before we do, I thought we might want to go on the very last item of the agenda and see if there's any new information about those future scheduling decisions that we tentatively made yesterday.
That's exactly right. I think my perception is, I think the last three items on the agenda has been taken care of in our first day of meeting.
Except just for that question about whether there's any new information.
Right.
So I agree. I think that we completed that. I have no knowledge of any additional scheduling that we need to work through. Pete says the same, I think.
No, I've talked to Bob and to Furman, but we've confirmed that the dates that we set yesterday are all good. So.
And the most important one was the moving of that public meeting by a day, and that's all set on all sides.
Right.
All right. Where's Bob? Yeah.
As we break. It's my understanding as well.
Right. Then let us take a break until our next speaker arrives.
That's the least flexibility.
Yes, we're a little ahead of a schedule.
Yeah, it's been done.
Right.
Yeah, we're a little ahead of schedule anyhow, so it's natural that he's not arrived yet, and we
right.
will. We
right.
will resume as
right.
soon as he gets here.
Right. He's not late. We are early. Technical people in the back, are we ready?
Jim, we went from the ethereal to the sublime when we went from subs to safety culture.
Okay. So are we ready for that, or yes?
Yes, it's our pleasure to welcome Mr. Jim Becker back to our proceeding. Do you need some time,
Mr.
Becker? Sure, please do. Right, please go get it.
Talk about a contract.
safety culture is every day. Sumps are once in a while.
As you may know, Mr. Becker is the site vice president at the Abel Cannon. He is the most senior manager on site. He is responsible for 1,500 employees' performances at the site. So welcome back, Mr. Becker. The podium is yours.
Thanks. So it's my pleasure to be here in front of the committee today, and as the slide states, my purpose is to give you an overview of nuclear safety culture. I will be referring in my presentation both to efforts underway at Diablo Canyon and also industry-wide, because the actions we're taking at Diablo are consistent with U.S. nuclear industry approaches. Mission also strongly incorporates safety culture in its regulatory oversight process. The NRC deals with safety culture attributes that are closely related to these eight principles, but they're not the same thing. So as a licensee, we deal, although it's closely related, we deal with safety culture issues in NRC space as well as with the INPO principles, and we have to be conversant in both. Yeah.
Jim, and as the public ought to know, and I know you know, the International Atomic Energy Agency has an advisory group that has issued a very useful report about safety culture, which has become a model overseas, okay. Most of which, by the way, started from and follows stuff that started in the United States.
Great. Good. Thank you. So let's talk about these principles, because this will bring it to life, I think, a little more what exactly I mean when I'm talking safety culture. So here are the eight principles, and first one is a broad one, that everyone is personally responsible for nuclear safety, that the craft, the engineers, the clerical folks, myself, everybody who works on site is responsible for it. That's that first attribute, first principle. Second principle does reflect that definition about leadership. Leaders do have a unique role in demonstrating a commitment to safety through our decisions, through our rewards and recognition, through our compensation. You know, all of the things we do reflect on safety. Trust is a very important part of a safety culture, so that trust that goes throughout the organization. We make decisions, large or small, every day, and we have a standardized decision-making template that does put safety first. That is reinforced every day at Diablo, as it is, I believe, at all U.S. nuclear plants. Nuclear technology is recognized as special and unique. So what's special and unique about it? Well, as I think was brought up in one of the presentations last night, a nuclear reactor, even once it's shut down, it continues to produce heat, and that heat must be removed. And Fukushima was an example of that. So that is one example of a unique, special and unique attribute of nuclear technology. So our safeguards, our decision-making, our approaches need to be reflective of that. A questioning attitude is cultivated. This is very important. Questioning attitude could be summed up as constantly asking ourselves, well, what could go wrong here? What problems could we have in doing this upcoming task or evolution? And therefore, once we ask ourselves that question, okay, so what are we going to do about it? What's our contingency? How do we reflect that in our preparations? Questioning attitude is very important. Organizational learning is embraced. This is the principle that no organization, no person is perfect. There's always opportunities to improve. So how well we capture those opportunities to improve and carry them forward in our business, that's what Principle 7 is about. And then Principle 8, nuclear safety undergoes constant examination. This is fairly broad. The one aspect of it I'll touch on here, although it's not the only aspect, is our industry has a fair amount of Now, our industry has quite a bit of oversight. We have the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which has an oversight function. We have internal oversight groups at the plant. We have the Institute INPO, which is a form of oversight. I would offer the purpose of this committee could be summed up in some ways as oversight. So having that function be effective and vibrant and used and useful, that's what Principle 8 is about. So that's a quick run through, and again, that's how INPO has defined. I think these are well defined and spelled out, and all U.S. nuclear plants reinforce these daily. At Diablo, we have our site standards handbook that talks about observable standards at the plant, and this is number one in that site standards handbook. So that was an overview. When we talk about safety culture, and we certainly look at it from a regulatory standpoint, which from NRC standpoint is closely related to those principles I just talked about, one aspect of safety culture that the NRC includes, which is very important, is called safety-conscious work environment. Sometimes you'll hear us abbreviate that as SCWE, but that's what it means, a safety-conscious work environment. And we'll read through this definition here. And this is also in our site standards handbook. Individuals feel free and are openly willing to identify and raise issues, questions, or concerns, expressing differing professional opinions or viewpoints dealing with nuclear or radiological safety, quality, security, regulatory compliance, and do so without fear of retaliation. Issues identified are addressed promptly with timely feedback to the initiator. So this is a pretty all-encompassing definition. The center of it is that people can raise concerns without fear of retaliation, but it doesn't end there. It goes on that not only is it safe to bring things up, and I would say encouraged, but that when issues are brought up, they are addressed, prompted into our corrective action program. If for some reason they're not satisfied with that response, or they just choose not to go to their supervisor, they can always go to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission with any concerns that they have. So that's a legal obligation we have to make that available to them. And then, so once that concern gets identified and it gets addressed one way or the other, maybe the employee isn't satisfied. Maybe the employee doesn't feel that the way it was dispositioned was correct. Well, that person still has various avenues. At Diablo, we have a process called DPO, or Differing Professional Opinion. It's an administrative procedure, but it's a way for an employee to raise that, saying, you know, this, I brought this issue up, I'm not satisfied with how it's been handled, and it's a fact-finding way for that employee to raise the issue and to be heard in a formal manner and have, you know, the folks who perhaps disagree with that employee or who have handled the issue in a different manner, also for them to be heard and get those facts out on the table, and then we go through a path to resolution per that procedure. That's the next level that employees can use. If that's not does not meet the needs of the employee, or if the employee doesn't choose to use that, they can still go to what's called an employee concerns program. All plants, by their license, have an employee concerns program, which is a program where employees can anonymously, if they so choose, if they want to be anonymous, raise issues to the employee concerns program, and then the ECP folks will investigate the issue, and they will report out on their findings on the issue to senior management, and that is also done. Lastly, I talked about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The employee could take the issue, if they were dissatisfied, directly to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they would do an investigation. And the NRC has an investigative branch for that.
Now, at the site, Mr. Becker, are you the ultimate arbiter of the DPO process and the employee concern program?
I'll take them one at a time.
Are you the ultimate?
The employee concerns program reports to the chief nuclear officer, who is my boss, and so he receives the reports, and he reviews and approves or not the work of the employee concerns program. So although I am informed as necessary of their findings, I'm not the adjudicator generally.
I see, because I do have a...
And that is presumably because you, on the site, could be the subject of one of those
Absolutely.
Concerns.
Absolutely, that's right. That's an example.
And your supervisor, not on the site like you are...
Correct.
...has a higher PG&E stature.
Right, that's right. Yep.
Oh, so the chief nuclear officer is the arbiter of this process.
The employee concerns program, yes.
Well, what about the DPO process?
The DPO process is covered in an administrative procedure, and, you know, I don't want to, we have used the process. But I'm not clear on, you know, sort of the final adjudicator. We can get back to you on that. I don't want to guess here. It is a defined process. We have used it. It's laid out in a procedure. I know the process. What the process tries to drive to is in the final analysis, it tries to drive to a consensus. We may not get there, but it does try to drive to some sort of a consensus.
Sure, you know, in any dispute, I'm sure you go
right,
through many
exactly.
of them.
Right.
You know, yes. It's very difficult to make everybody happy at the beginning.
Right. That's right. So good. Good questions, and that wraps up a quick discussion of the safety conscious work environment. We could talk a little bit about Diablo Canyon more specifically now, because so far everything that I've gone over really would apply to any U.S. nuclear plant. And now to get a little more specific, safety culture at Diablo Canyon, we are making improvements to our safety culture process at the plant. We are increasing our communications with our plant staff in several areas. The importance of a sound nuclear safety culture. So while it may seem in discussing it that it's obvious that this is very important, and I don't think anybody would argue with that, we have found that it is necessary to reinforce those principles, those eight principles, the definition of a nuclear safety culture. We do reinforce that through leadership development training, through communications messages and other venues, because it's important to us that employees recognize what a nuclear safety culture really is. If you don't know what it is, then you are at greater risk of losing it, of losing a strong culture. So that is something we have focused on, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, to reinforce both what a safety culture is and what a safety institute. It's an industry working group, and they put out various documents and guidance for the industry to adopt. And in this case, the guidance is around actions to take to foster a strong nuclear safety culture. So what I'm about to describe is being done in some manner at all U.S. nuclear plants now. So the center of this NEIO 907 document is called a Safety Culture Monitoring Panel. And we have now put that in place at Diablo. This is a fairly new attribute at Diablo, but we have now put this SCMP in place. The document places primary responsibility on line management, and in particular on the site leadership team for nuclear safety culture, to collect input from a variety of data sources, assessment results, employee concerns program data, corrective action program data, and to look for trends or indicators that that would be representative of problems, incipient problems in our nuclear safety culture, or strong points in our nuclear safety culture. That's what the Safety Culture Monitoring Panel is intended to do, and then it reports out to senior leadership periodically on what its findings are and what its recommendations are. Broadly, that's the purpose of a Safety Culture Monitoring Panel, and again, the idea is that the line is monitoring its own safety culture and adjusting course as necessary. As I said, the Safety Culture Monitoring Panel, it monitors inputs from various sources that are indicative of the health of our safety culture. It is a diverse team. It's headed by our Director of Quality Verification. It is a diverse team with experienced personnel from various departments. The Safety Culture Monitoring Panel reports out on at least a quarterly basis to the site leadership team. So that's site leadership team is Ken Peters, myself, and our directors at the plant. That's the SLT. So we get at least on a quarterly basis reports from this panel. We've had two such reports so far, and we're welcome to share those with the committee here. And it also says, you know, we don't want the membership of the SCMP to be too broad. Really, what we're talking about here is, you know, we want it to be the size of the group to be workable in size. We don't want it to be too broad. So we want it to be effective And so we do limit the membership somewhat. Some changes we intend, so as I said, we've had two report outs so far from the from this panel to the senior leadership team. I have personally observed a strength in such an approach at another plant where those report outs were done not just to the senior leadership team, but to all employees who were invited to attend a report out so that everybody could learn of what the panel was coming up with. So I have now directed that at Diablo we are going to move in that direction. So the report outs will be to a broader audience. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's the same plan as you knew, and you don't have to know, but there's one I know where all the managers, down to first-line managers, have that, and each first-line manager is charged with making sure that there's a personal interaction with the small group that's under them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so what I'm talking about is similar.
Similar to that.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's to get it more broad. So, again, the more the issues that get identified obviously are important and we'll take action on them. But what, in my opinion, is just as important is just site awareness of safety culture in general. And, you know, what our strengths and relative weaknesses are and what we're doing. But just that awareness is healthy just in and of itself. And that's what we're going for. We have, the next slide talks about safety culture results. And we have undergone, the NRC, as I said, safety culture is an important part of the NRC oversight process. So as part of that process, we have undergone a number of NRC inspections that examine our nuclear safety culture. The latest one was in July of this year, and it used the inspection manual referenced here. That inspection went well. The NRC issued no violations as a result of the inspection. They did provide us feedback on our safety culture that we are acting on, and the communication steps I was talking about earlier is some of our reaction to what the NRC identified through their inspection. They also identified some strengths in that they did clearly note that employees felt universally that they were that it was safe for them to raise concerns and that they would not hesitate to raise a concern through at least one, if not.
Observation I have yesterday at the end of our sponsored tour, planned tour at Diablo, I was sitting in the training center launch and waiting for the bus. Two gentlemen came by. The names are Mr. James Clymer and Mr. James Smith. Both work on site as a radiological monitoring technicians.
Correct. Yep.
We had a very pleasant conversation about safety culture. Mm-hmm. Both gentlemen had, I came away with the impression that both gentlemen felt personally responsible for their activity on site regarding nuclear safety. Now, that's an observation that impressed me. I walk away with a warm feeling that indeed your safety culture program are succeeding.
Yes, that is what you say is exactly what we want.
Right, so that's a comment I want to share with the
and
members
of
the
public. Those are long-term employees.
I frankly, it's the first time I met them, and it was a casual encounter. It was not a scheduled meeting. Yep. Both gentlemen at the beginning did not know who I am.
Yeah.
And so good. That's something for feedback for everybody here.
Great.
I have a question, no clarification.
Yeah.
I thought I heard you say that the safety culture monitoring panel was not yet implemented.
Oh, no. If I said that was a mistake. The safety culture monitoring panel is implemented.
Yeah.
They have reported out two times to the senior leader. It was implemented this year, so it's a recent development. They've reported out to the SLT twice, and so that we will continue that, but we're also going to be looking for ways to enhance it.
That's why I asked. I thought you said that. Then I heard you talk about the fact, so it is implemented.
Okay. Sure. Yes, it is.
Jim?
Just
a couple things. Dan Brosnan just made a presentation on the containment sump screens.
Good.
And part of that, he was talking about the testing of the screens that they'd done. Mm-hmm. The NRC oversaw or the results or whatever.
Right.
And then he just attached a comment from the NRC, which says, overall, the NRC staff was impressed with a questioning attitude
yeah.
of Diablo Canyon personnel and the depth of evaluation, and went on. Again, just reflection of what's embedded as a safety cultural aspect. The other thing I just mentioned is that Dr. Peterson and I were involved in the July fact-finding trip, where we reviewed the station's response to that manual trip that came as a result of the leaking relief valve flange on the feed water heater
resulted
in the trip of the feed pump and
Correct.
So on.
Right.
And, of course, it looked at the gasket and the torquing requirements and that kind of thing. But then it went more broadly into, well, how widespread is this issue?
Right.
But then what was very impressive, and I mean really impressive, was mm-hmm. about, I'd say, a 25% of the root cause analysis
right.
was on cultural aspects,
right.
and it was an excellent examination of why was this thing done, why was this thing overlooked or whatever. And to me, it was and to us as a team, it was a reflection on it's a cultural thing that drives you in that direction. And it was very evident in that root cause analysis.
Yeah, thank you. That is, although I didn't include that in the slides here, that is another recent change we made. All root cause analyses that we do now, and what you were reading was one of them, they all now address safety culture aspects as part of their
review. Oh, so that was a conscious decision to
make. Yes, it is.
Wow.
That's a change
okay,
we made
great.
This year.
Okay.
So if you looked at a 2010 or 9 root cause, you would not see
right.
that. But effective this year, we've added that to all of our root causes. Yep.
Dr. Peterson, comments? Dr. Bennis?
Yeah. I assume, in fact, darn it, I know that people like you are in periodic communication with your peers elsewhere in the amongst our other 60-odd sites
sure.
and 100
yep.
plants. Do you have any reports about whether Diablo is well ahead of or about the same as or lagging behind?
In terms of process?
Our sister plants.
As far as the process, like this NEI document, we are, I think we were toward the head of the line in getting that process in place. If I recall, the industry expectation is that safety culture monitoring panel would be in place by the end of this year, is my recollection. Now, many plants have now gotten there, but I think we were kind of sort of, not the first, but I believe we were toward the front of it.
But that's good.
As far as the health of our safety culture, it would be hard to compare us to another plant, frankly. It's a subjective thing, and so it would be hard for me to compare the health of our safety culture. We know the actions were taken to improve it, but from a process standpoint, the industry is pretty standardized. I think we were a little earlier than some in putting that in place. And the same thing with the root causes. I don't know that all plants have gone to addressing safety culture aspects in all of their root causes. I believe that more and more plants are doing that. So, yep.
With no more comments from the committee, 64 public meeting.
But before you do, may I have to say two things?
Please. Yes, please.
Okay,
yes, please.
One is, I know we approved the annual report, and I will take that and get with Bob Rathy as far as getting the editorial and minor comments included. However, there are references to INPO in the report, and I would just ask the committee to let me go through and screen the report one last time to clear up or clean up any references to INPO that shouldn't be there or are too detailed we need to clarify.
Absolutely, yes, you should do that.
I think we're in pretty good shape, but I just want to do
I think
one
actually
last
our
check.
Correspondence reached that conclusion already, so I think you have authority to do that as a part
right.
of addressing our previous concerns.
I don't think it will result in any substantive changes, but if
not.
It does, I'll let the committee know. I do
no,
think
but you should do that.
And I might add that we'd ask PG&E's assistance. We will provide the report, as we always do, for a 45-day review. And we all can cooperate and be on the same
yeah,
page.
Just to explain to the members of the public who perhaps are here or watching, the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations does reviews of all the nuclear plants in the country. And reports of theirs that are confidential and not public reports come to us for our private consideration in due course, and we don't make them public, but they do help us understand things. And from time to time, a reference to an INPO, something or other, creeps in where it shouldn't have, and we just want to make sure that we've honored our pledge to confidentiality and not inadvertently let it go the other way. That's what this is about.
Okay. Well then, well said.
I have one more point, sorry.
All right, Mr. Waddell.
Different subject. We talked about on the open items list in our review of Fukushima breaking down into its various components. Mm-hmm. And I sent to the committee a list of proposed categories for that. And I think the best thing to do would be for me just to send an email out requesting your comments on that, say in a couple of weeks, and then we can work on that and decide on it at the next meeting, perhaps. Unless you're prepared to talk about it now.
No, okay. No, I think your proposal.
I'll do that, and
it's well accepted.
Good.
Take it on as an item. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so finally, let me conclude by saying, we had passionate public participation at this public meeting. I want to thank Ms. Lewis in particular for your participation and other members of the public who have spoken before us. Let me repeat that your comments will be in our minutes, will be in our annual report, and will be kept at the Robert Kennedy Library at Cal Poly University. And also this meeting has been productive and useful. In no small part, thank you to Mr. Becker and his staff in preparing 8 different professional presentations. Both the contents and the style are done in utmost superior and excellent fashions. And thank you for that. And also, last but not least, to Mr. Pete Batterson as the committee's liaison. He had interacted very effectively with all our needs. And also, we'd like to thank Dr. Bundes. Just remind me to thank our 2 capable technicians in the back who do all the video streaming. And thanks again. That said, the 64 public meeting is now adjourned. Until the next time, thank you.